understand that the dust is on the ground here, and we thought that we would move ahead so that we wouldn't take up too much more of your time. One of the reasons why we're here is that we've trained Franklin, the lady that's waiting on that corner. She's the stakeholder relations manager for Northern Diocese. And one of the tasks that we've been assigned, I include myself in it because although I'm not employed by Northern Diocese, I have a contract to provide outreach services. I like to think of myself as a kind of a connector. I really don't have, and it's hard to believe that I don't have the kind of emotion and opinions about Norman Dynasty that I probably should have. When I go out to the communities and conduct these kind of meetings, people ask me what I thought of, what I think of the mine, and my response has always been that the Northern Dynasty hasn't completed its studies. And until then, I'm going to withhold my opinion on whether or not I have an opinion or not. So that's what I've been, that's where I'm from, and I'm a commercial fisherman from Nagnik, Crystal Bay. I've been told at one of the meetings that I come from a family that has over 50 permits for fishing in the Crystal Bay fishery. So we do have a kind of a family investment in the fishery, and it's something that we want to see as we move forward. Certainly myself, my son runs my boat permit now, so I can just see how we're starting to evolve into the next level of life. I don't know if that's good or bad. It could be good, I guess, but if you really don't want to get old, I guess it is bad. In any event, we're here because, as I mentioned, Heidi and I traveled out to Seattle a year ago last spring. We met with Peter Pan people, and we met with five managers. And we came down on two different occasions, and one of the meetings, I believe it was with, both of them, one of the meetings with Peter Pan, they asked why we weren't meeting with fishermen down here. And then a month later, Heidi and I came back down and met with a number of Triton's managers, and we were also, we came away with the same query that we needed to be in touch with more fishermen. Fishermen in this area are considered stakeholders in this process. The Northern Dynasty process. I won't go into the particulars of it. Everybody has it well publicized, but the people that are in the room and are commercial fishermen and the subsistence and users of that area, you're all Northern Dynasty, in their mind, you're a stakeholder. And that's why we come down to these places like Seattle or wherever stakeholders live. I did a kind of a quick look at drift permits, commercial fishing permits in Bristol Bay, and there are more people outside of Bristol Bay than home itself owning permits. And so we know that we just can't go to Bristol Bay and expect to have the kind of information that we think is important for you to make a decision. The meeting that we're holding here is that we're not intending, nor is it our intention to sway in any way on whether or not the mine goes forward or not. What we plan to do today is to provide you with the latest information that Northern Dynasty has regarding its study process. And since Bruce generally would make this a real good, would open the way for the rest of the team to come in behind him, but since he's not here, we're going to start with Michael Smith, the permitting. And so Michael is the manager of permitting, and he will be giving a presentation regarding the process that Northern Dynasty is going to be using, as well as their requirements underneath of their process. So Mike, do you have a microphone?
Hi, good evening. A few thoughts. My name is Mike Smith. I've been taking around Alaska, I guess, since about 1962. I've lost a lot of hair in the process. My area of expertise is in the resource management for virtually all of those 35, 36 years. And for the last 20, I've been very heavily involved in the environmental permitting aspects of large projects. In one way or another, I've been involved in almost all of the large mining projects in Alaska, the TAPS oil pipeline, the proposed TAGS gas pipeline, and I've been contracted by Northern Dynasty to handle their area of permitting and the NEPA, which is the federal, basically, environmental impact statement process. And so that's my main function. In starting off, it's always a good idea for somebody to lighten up a group with a little bit of humor. And I decided the best thing was to tell you a joke, which was the flight down this morning, why we were a little bit late getting here. We were just ready for pushback when it was announced that the pipes in the plane had frozen and they didn't have any water to make coffee. So we sat there for 16 minutes and then finally pushed back. I never did thaw out. There was no water for coffee. We were using bottled water to wash our hands in the laboratories. And as somebody said after the flight, a little bit ironic that Alaska Airlines in Anchorage on the ground is having their pipes freezing. You know, it's what, 80 below or something when they're up there in the air. So a lot of grumbling on the plane today with no coffee on the way down. My purpose today is to give you a brief background about the permitting aspects of the project. And I have tried to take a kind of standard, more in-depth presentation on the real nuts and bolts of how permitting works and strip that down to have a much less detailed presentation with the idea of leaving more time for questions. Because I don't know exactly your background with respect to the environmental permitting process, which is, at least in large projects in Alaska, is pretty well known and understood. Now, can everybody see, am I assuming I'm blocking some people over here? Okay, I'll have to move in and move out of my computer there to do this. I have a slide here at the beginning. I'm going to show you the same slide at the end. These are the kind of key points that I want to kind of emphasize as we go through this, and the points I kind of want to leave you with. One, Pebble is in the early stages of the permitting process. We are probably are at least a year, very likely more, before we actually formally start the major permitting process. So anybody that thinks that this is a done deal just does not understand reality. We don't have a proposed project yet. And until you have a proposed project, you don't even begin to think about applying for your major permits. That permitting process will be exceedingly rigorous and detailed. Pebble has gotten a lot of high-profile work, and somebody who's been around the area of environmental permitting as long as I do knows that there's a direct correlation between public concern and interest in a project and the length of the environmental permitting process. So it's going to be rigorous and probably extended. But I also want to emphasize that that process, by nature, specifically designed to be, is a public process. And if you participate in it, and hopefully you will, by the end of it, you will be ground down, just like the company, because there will be many meetings, many opportunities for comment, many documents to review. You can get into it as deep as you want. Now, I've jumped to a slide that you're going to see three or four times during the presentation, and the idea is just to kind of give you a handle on permitting and how it fits into the whole process. This is a typical mine project flow diagram, and you have kind of six stages here in the life of a mine. You have the initial exploration stage when the geologists are flying around in helicopters trying to find something out there. Once they found something, they get some holes stuck down, they start getting some results. they cross a threshold, which from the company's perspective is, you know, we may have something here. And it moves into advanced exploration. And that's where we are right now. We are in advanced exploration. Extended, as Bruce will tell you, starting about 2 years ago because of the finding of a higher value, in other words, richer ore deposit underground east of the original western deposit. So this is where we are right now. And somewhere in here, and we're obviously getting close to that, or actually have passed it, the company says, we've got the promise here enough, we're going to start doing what we need to do to start the permitting process in earnest when it comes. And as we'll see, that involves baseline studies. We've now finished our third summer of intense baseline studies. Project design, give and take back and forth between these two very important functions. Then we'll move into the permitting stage, and we'll talk about that. Most of my presentation will be about this. Once permitting is finished, if the project is permitted, you get into development, the actual construction, the actual operations, depending on the mines, could be 5 or 6 years, could be 5 or 6 decades. In this case, with the size of this deposit, it's much more likely to be closer to the latter than the former. And finally, the closure and final reclamation of the project, which, depending upon the project, can last 3 to 5 years, or can last 30 years or more. It all depends on the size of the project. So what we're talking about here is going to be basically the permitting side of things. And this last part of advanced exploration with our baseline studies and project design. Now, key terms that I want to define here. First, the permitting process. Next, we're going to talk about NEPA. And thirdly, what is an EIS? So, what is environmental permitting? First of all, let me back up and go into those terms. The permitting process begins when a company, and as I say, we pass that threshold internally, says, we have a possibility here of a project, and we're going to start spending some money, time, and effort to identify a baseline. Baseline is another word for going out to the area and looking at what's there before there's any impact to the project. And that's where we get the term baseline. It's the level against which you will measure any changes that you think may occur, and if the project goes ahead and you monitor, you will actually use that baseline to determine if the changes are actually occurring. And we are past that point now, and this permitting process goes all the way until the company ultimately is given the last piece of paper, which is the last permit it needs to actually get out there and operate its project. And we've got a list, I'll throw up a few later, but we're on 67 permits, and these are what we call the more major ones. There's going to be a lot of other more minor ones involved. Now, what is NEPA? NEPA is the acronym for the National Environmental Policy Act. This is strictly a federal act passed in 1969 at the beginning of the Environmental Revolution, as it was called. And it is the act that requires that the federal government, whenever it takes an action, that the person who's about to sign a document to take an action understands what the environmental impacts are going to be. There can be impacts. NEPA doesn't say that there can't be impacts, but it insists that the person before they sign a piece of paper saying that a project can go ahead, that they fully understand what the environmental impacts are going to be. Because in some cases, particularly like major military facilities or national security issues like that, there are definitely impacts. But the ultimate decision is it's more important to go ahead. But the very process of going through that forces the military or anybody else to minimize those impacts. And that was the basic function of NEPA in the first place. Finally, the term EIS. EIS stands for Environmental Impact Statement. It is part of the NEPA process, just as NEPA is part of the permitting process. And this is the process that ultimately results in a huge document basically dissects every aspect of the project, talks about what the environmental impacts are expected to be depending upon which of the options to build the project are actually partly selected. And it serves as the basis for the ultimate record of decision that the agencies will make when they decide yes, they're going to issue the permit, or no, they're not going to issue the permit. Now, generally, environmental permitting is the review process by which governments determine whether or not and how a project will be built. Just a public general discussion. And this occurs at the federal, state, and municipal levels. For PEBLE process, we have the federal aspects of it, primarily issues of clean water and, say, wetlands. You have the state aspects of it. It's all on state land, at least the mine project. The mine itself is on state land. And all of the various aspects of state control. And finally, you have municipal aspects. The Lake Peninsula Borough is the local government, and they ultimately will have to issue a permit that will allow the mine to go ahead. So the project has got to get permits at all three of those levels. I've actually covered that already. It begins when a company seriously believes it has an economic project until the last permit is issued. As you see here, permitting encompasses the permit application. When I mentioned the NEPA EIS process, as will definitely affect our project. And then finally, the permitting and adjudication decisions. And this is the area, once these permits are actually applied for, that brings in this entire area here. And I'm not going to go into detail now. If some people want me to go into it later, I'll be happy to. But this talks about the various steps in the process, where public opinion is involved, the specific things that have to happen. There are specific time limits that have to be met, minimum amounts of time that things are available to the public, certain times for public comments, etc. So all of this is the permitting process. This particular aspect is the EIS, NEPA part of it. And as you can see, it's a very large part of it. And adjacent to that is the individual agency permitting review, the state and federal agencies that go through this process, the EIS process, with their own specific responsibilities. And there's give and take throughout the entire process. And the idea of the agency is to say to whoever put it together, the EIS, look, we need to know these 17 things before we can issue a permit. Make sure that that's part of the EIS process. So the EIS is really a structure, a framework upon which all the various agencies hitch their boxcars to, you might say, so that they go through their processes in lockstep with the EIS process. Now, NEPA, these basically I've already touched on. It's part of the environmental permitting process. And the purpose is that the federal decision makers know the environmental impacts before they make a decision. It provides for full disclosure of all environmental impacts. And as I mentioned, is an aid to agencies doing their particular small part of the big picture with their individual permit. It's triggered by most federal actions. And this is important, as you'll see in the slide in a moment. Alaska doesn't have an Environmental Policy Act per se, but because of the amount of wetlands in Alaska, and because most mining projects have some kind of water discharge, it's almost impossible for a major mining project not to be involved in the EIS process, and certainly PEBLE will be involved in the EIS process. It's a public process. It also requires, interestingly, coordination and consultation with individual Indian tribal governments. So in addition to the role that residents of Bristol Bay have as, you know, citizens of the state with all the rights that all the other citizens have, tribal governments recognized by the United States have a special status with the federal government with respect to going through the NEPA process. And the agencies that will be involved in the PEBLE project will be working with those tribal governments as tribal governments, basically as sovereigns, in their own dialogue outside of the public arena. As I mentioned, the state of Alaska has no NEPA, but there's virtually no way that a large project in Alaska will not be covered by the EIS process. I mentioned the environmental impact statement. It's part of the NEPA process. It covers large projects. And the definition is that you have a EIS when a project may have a, quote, significant effect on the human environment. And again, PEBL certainly raises to that level, that the project could have a significant effect on the human environment. Therefore, there will be an EIS. And it's a procedural disclosure document. Again, a formal process that requires certain things to be disclosed. Information has to be available. And again, you'll be able to get into it to whatever gory detail you want. Part of the overall permitting process, a large part of the process, I don't have that slide, I'm sorry. I won't read it, you can certainly read it. Going back to the large part of the process, you can see NEPA is just the dominant issue in here, dominant aspect of the overall permitting process. Now, I'm going to talk about kind of the five steps that we have here with respect to the permitting process. Baseline studies I've alluded to. We are now finished with our third field season and are going to be putting this information by hopefully January, information from the first 2 years, 2004-2005, into our preliminary environmental baseline document. Ultimately, this will be a multiple loose-leaf binder document, which will be available, thank goodness, on CDs as well as in hard copy, and will be available during the course of the EIS process. The company will submit this basically at the time, shortly before it actually files its formal permits. And so the opportunity for people to look and just see what that baseline is, what's out there now. We have a large number of consulting firms, the large majority of them will ask base, that are doing this work for us. Next, we have project design. As more and more information is gathered, particularly with respect to what's coming from the drill rigs, as far as what the ore body looks like, the grades, where the locations are, et cetera, we have a consulting engineering firm, Knight Piesold, and we have the head engineer who will be presenting a little bit later from that perspective. And put together, initial project designs. And as you saw in that diagram before, that those designs are changed sometimes substantially by information that comes from the baseline program. This is an iterative process. If the design people say, well, they want to look at something else, well, people getting to baseline go over there and look at those other places. Very much an iterative process. The whole idea is to design from the beginning to minimize impacts. We don't wait for the environmental impact statement process to do that. Then you have your formal permit applications, documents, forms that various agencies have, and which will require, depending upon the permit, all sorts of specific types of information. And a lot of that will come from the baseline studies. You then have the NEPA and EIS process, which I've already talked about. And finally, at the end, the actual permit adjudication and the ultimate decisions that come from those. Back to the diagram again. That last part occurs here after the final EIS is actually published. And based upon that EIS, each agency, and as I say, we've got a minimum of 67 permits identified already, each agency, based upon the information that they received, largely that's come from the EIS, will actually do an ROD, a record of decision, and in it they will defend why they are issuing their permit, what the bases are, or why they are not issuing that permit. Now, I certainly don't tend to read all these, but just to give you an idea of some of the more major permits, and again, the purpose of this goes back to that first slide to show you how rigorous an environmental permitting process would be. EPA, if we have a water discharge, will probably be the lead agency if they still retain authority to do it at that point. And with the lead EIS process, we have a review of the Corps of Engineers 404 permit, spill prevention countermeasures, plans for any types of spills that may occur out there, stormwater, hazardous waste generation, all these are very separate aspects of the process. The Army Corps of Engineers has the wetlands responsibility. There are a lot of wetlands in the area of the project. A lot of effort has been made to identify and avoid them. Still, the size of the project will impact a significant amount of wetlands. Navigational concerns at our proposed port site. We have to meet those strictures. Cultural and historical resources protection responsibilities. Jumping to the state, as I mentioned, this is on state land. The Department of Natural Resources has two types of authority. They have the authority as landowner, just like you own your parcel of land and you can control what goes on that land as a landowner. The state also has sovereign authority as the state government over certain aspects of things. And those are combined for all these things, for getting rights away from the road, the pipeline, the hillside lease, if you're building structures on tie lines, the certificate of approval to construct, and a separate certificate to operate a dam. This is going to be an extremely detailed process where experts from around the country are going to sit on a board that's going to review all aspects of the engineering design of this project, and until they feel comfortable and basically the state concurs, nothing's going to happen. Again, fish passage permits, fish habitat permits, which will control very much what impacts, if any, occur on fish. Department of Environmental Conservation, they don't own the land, they get more into the sovereign authority of things for disposing of waste, air quality control permits, or dust that we may have, or generators that we may use, wastewater treatment plants, drinking water systems for people, domestic water systems for people in the camp, again, spill plan reviews, storm water discharge, a very long list of permits which we'll have to get. Just to cover up a couple examples of major environmental impact statements that you're probably familiar with, the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, the more recent Fort Greely anti-ballistic missile interceptor program at Fort Greely. Virtually all Alaska hard rock mines have gone through the EIS process. Nuclear power plants in the lower 48. So people who say, oh, this is such a big project, you know, the permitting process isn't going to be able to handle it, you know, wrong. This project is nowhere near as big as some other projects that have been built and have gone through their very rigorous process and have come out and done fine. Now, as I mentioned at the beginning, the takeaway points, same as at the beginning, that Pebble is in the very early stages of the permitting phase, certainly at least a year until major permits will be applied for, and perhaps more. Until we get a handle on just what that resource is in the East Zone, it's going to be very difficult to have a definitive project description. There will be this rigorous state and federal permitting process, which has been the main thrust of my presentation here. And finally, the full public participation aspect of it. You will have every opportunity, as long as you make sure you make your interest known, you get on the mailing lists, what have you, you'll be inundated with as much information as you're likely to want. So I now ask if people have any questions.
Well, maybe because we got such a late start that we might hold our questions to the end. You'll note that on your agenda and the packet that you would have received at the door, we have allocated some time for questions toward the end, and that would give enough time for the presenters to give their full benefit to their presentations. Next up on the agenda, I'm sorry, Mike, I didn't hear you on that before, but we're going to move back to the agenda and go with the Pebble Line project update. And today we have Ruth Jenkins, who's the Chief Operating Officer, and he will be giving the presentation and update. Bruce?
Thank you. Good afternoon. It's a lovely day for meeting inside, but it allows you to get a fly. We started for our delay, but it's out of our hands. We wanted to give you an update on our project because there's a lot of misinformation in the press. A lot of rhetoric is flying around about the status of the Pebble project, and The purpose of presenting this information to you today is to try to clarify the record, give you, if you will, straight goods, honest information, where we are, and more importantly, where we're not. And in recognition of your interests in some of the technical issues associated with the design and construction and operation of this mine, we've also brought along a number of our senior staff members and senior consultants. They are here as independent people, covering their particular disciplines, as you see from the agenda. We bring them to share with you the work they've done to date. They are here with their own opinions and their own answers to questions based on the science that they've been doing. So I encourage you to ask them questions and get an understanding of the kind of work that they've been doing. One other comment I want to make before I go into my presentation, and that is I want to assure you that I'm not here today to try to convince you that you should support the Pebble Project. And that's not my objective today. It's not my purpose. That's not why we're here. We're here to share information. We're in our third year in the project development stage, getting ready for permitting, which is still a year or two away. And we've been committed to an open-door policy with information. And we're here to share, to enlighten, to answer questions. And that's the only purpose. I would ask one thing, and that is that you be discerning in your consideration and all the information you hear about our project, not only ours, but information you hear from other sources, particularly other sources who have ideological reasons for wanting to oppose our project. I want to stress that I encourage contrary views on our project. This is a democracy, and I encourage that because an open, frank, objective dialogue is healthy. What I don't encourage is misinformation and propaganda campaigns that uses erroneous facts and erroneous information to try to persuade people to deny us the due process of the state and federal permitting process that Dr. Smith just outlined for you. We have a right to be where we are, and we're going to proceed with the permitting of this project. And if we're not successful, then we fail, and we'll pack our bags and walk home. We're optimistic and confident we can get this project permitted because of our multi-decades of experience doing it on other projects and because of the precedents in the state of Alaska. So having said that, where are we on Pebble? Just to reinforce, we are on state land and it's entirely, and the entire deposit is on state land that's designated for mining. We're about 19 miles northwest of Illiamna, and we're more than 35 miles away from Lake Clark National Park and Preserve. We're in completely different watersheds and a couple of mountain ranges away. In 2005, the Bristol Bay Area Management Plan was updated by the Department of Natural Resources after an extensive public consultation process. In that updated plan that they published last May, I believe it was, there were more than 30 references to the Pebble Project, extolling its virtues as a geological resource, articulating the magnitude and significance of that deposit, and reaffirming the designation of that state land for mineral exploration and development. Finally, at the 50,000 foot level, based on our drilling at the end of last year, we have now confirmed that we have the largest contained copper and gold resource in all of North America. It's a world-class project, it's significant, it's big, and we're being very careful in how we design it and engineer it. And you'll see that as our studies unfold and as we have more meetings and as we get ready for the permitting process. Next. So our location, Mike, you have a laser pointer. Thank you. So here's Anchorage up here. We're about an hour by air down to Illiamna, and about 17, 18 miles northwest of Illiamna, and the Pebble deposit is situated there. Next slide. We're looking at, to date, Pebble West deposit, which was an open-pittable resource of more than 4 billion tons. And this is the kind of conceptual mine-site facilities that we would be looking at. A large open pit with a pit rim crusher, conveyor belt, and then the mill where you would grind the ore extracted from the pit and put it through a grinding flotation system and extract the concentrate. The concentrate would be 25% to 30% metal, and the rest would still be waste rock in the fine flour form. And we are looking at a mechanism right now of putting it in a water-based slurry that would go through a 7-inch, 8-inch diameter pipeline that would be put underneath the buried underneath the edge of the road and taken to the port site, where it would be dewatered and the dry concentrate would be put in a freighter or taken to overseas smelters. Things have changed a lot since then because of our discovery of the Pebble East deposit. Next. But one thing that hasn't changed is the need to store tailings or the leftovers from the mill process that's at the tail end of the milling. That's why they call it tailings. So we need to construct a large tailings storage facility where we put waste rock and the tailings from the mill and store it. It would be a large impoundment, and Ken Brower from Mike Pizzo will be giving you more details on this later. But this is a plan view that shows the pit area, the road coming in from the port, the mill area to the west of the pit, and then the tailings pipelines that would discharge tailings behind the embankments to the north and the embankments to the south. Ken Brower is going to describe in detail how we went through an alternatives analysis to find the best, least environmentally sensitive site for the location of the tailings pond as part of our commitment to an environmentally designed driven project, a project that minimizes the size of the footprint and locates facilities in low environmentally sensitive areas. Next. So where are we today? We're still gathering geological, engineering, and environmental data. We're nowhere near finalizing the plan or the design of the project. We thought we were going to have a feasibility study by the end of last year, but we had to put that into abeyance because of the discovery of the Pebble East deposit. To the end of last year, we had spent $72 million on the project, and of that, in addition, in 06, we were looking at spending $40 million. About 3 months ago, the board increased that by 50%, so our budget this year is $60 million. So we're doing a lot more drilling. We're going back to the drawing board with the engineering because we now have a deposit on the west which is open pitable, but we have a much richer deposit to the east which seems to lend itself to underground block cave mining. So this new discovery has taken us back to the drawing boards, and we're now looking how do we put together an optimized project design that takes the Pebble East underground deposit from, and the Pebble West open pit deposit. Next. This gives you, first of all, a plan view, looking at the deposit area, and a transect from X to Y cuts through the Pebble West open pitable deposit and the Pebble East. And as you see this cross section, you can quickly see why we have two different types of deposits. This causing us to go back to the engineering drawing board. The open pit that we were doing the feasibility study on was located in the Pebble West area. Now the colors you see reflect the various grades called copper equivalents. So anything that's red is the highest grade. That's greater than 0.7% copper equivalent. The orange is greater than 0.5%, and the yellow is greater than 0.3% copper equivalent. What you should notice in Pebble West, where we were designing the open pit project, is that there's a high-grade core in the center of the pit area, very close to and at the surface. That means it has a very low stripping ratio. It's very economic for mining. So we were continuing with our feasibility study on that open pit project, but as we drilled off to the eastern extension of the pit, we began to find at greater depth this high-grade area. And we drilled it off with a total of about 20 holes last year and found the Pebble East deposit here. You can see that it's underneath the cover rock, which is not mineralized, and it's thousands of feet down. That's the 2,000 foot level here. And it goes down a mile, and it may be even deeper. We haven't fully delineated it yet. If you look at how red that is, you can see it's much richer. On average, the grade of the Pebble East deposit is 3 times the grade of the Pebble West deposit. It's one of the reasons we're convinced that it can be mined by underground block caving. So you can see by that figure that we have really two deposits that have to be mined in some kind of integrated fashion. And that's why we've delayed our permit applications, because we've got to design the optimized project first before we initiate the formal state and federal permitting process. Next. In terms of the resource that we have, a measured and indicated, that's the highest accuracy estimate of the amount of metal you have in the ground. We had 31 million ounces of gold, in excess of 18 billion pounds of copper, and roughly a billion pounds of molybdenum. Inferred resources added another 11 million ounces of gold, close to 6 billion pounds of copper, and almost half a billion pounds of molybdenum. Now, you do the math based on today's metal prices, you'll see that this deposit at Pebble has an in-ground, metal-in-the-ground value of in excess of $150 to $200 billion. That's the value of the metal in the ground. Now, when you mine it, you don't get all the metal out. But I want to put it in the context. That's a very valuable deposit. And I think that those statistics should give you some sense as to why the shareholders of the company and the directors are ready, willing, and able to take the risk to invest hundreds of millions of dollars to get this project permitted and designed and built and operated, because it's a very valuable deposit. Now, Pebble East has added these numbers you see in red on the right-hand side. So there's an additional 22 million ounces of gold in Pebble East, plus 24 billion pounds of copper, 1.5 billion pounds of molybdenum, and growing. We have, this year, we're putting $15 to $20 million into an extended drill program with bigger drill rigs that can drill deeper to delineate the full extent of the deposit. Because until we do that, we can't design the project. And until we design the project, we can't take it permitting. Next. Our activities in 06, we've continued now in our third year of environmental and socioeconomic studies. And Dr. Buell and others will be talking about the studies that we've been doing there, some of the studies at least. A lot of community and stakeholder relations effort, reaching out to the various communities and interested stakeholders like yourselves to share information about who we are, what we're doing, and what our plans are. We've been issuing a lot of contracts in the region. Close to $3 million went through the Iliamna area alone last year, and more than that this year. Local hire, very significant local hire and workforce development and training program underway. Our plan is by the end of 07 to prepare an integrated development plan. That's in essence a marriage of the feasibility study work that we did for Pebble West open pit project, and marrying that with the engineering for the Pebble East deposit and putting it into an integrated mine plan. And that will in essence provide the basis for our permit applications. At the earliest, that will be prepared by the end of next year. And I stress at the earliest, because drilling will extend through 2007, and in our business, typically, it takes longer time than you plan than shorter time to get things done, because there's a lot of unpredictable factors in the drill program here, trying to delineate the depth and extent of the resource. Next. In terms of our expenditures, to the end of 06, $132 million total will have been spent. And of that, $54 million, more than one-third of the total expenditure, will have been spent on the environmental and socioeconomic programs. That should give you some indication of how seriously Northern Dynasty takes the importance of designing and building a project that, in a manner that protects the fish and the water and the other natural resources. And on that note, you should be aware that the reason I was asked to be the chief operating officer of the company is because not only have I more than 30 years of experience in this business of resource development and permitting and government relations, but my master's degree is in fisheries ecology. So I'm a biologist by training. Bit of a strange bird for a mining company, but it was for that very reason and because of my many years of experience working in sensitive areas with large mega projects and getting them permitted in a fashion that allows for the project together with environmental protection. That was a significant need on this project in view of the sensitivity in Bristol Bay. Next. Well, we have a responsible mineral development policy, and I could spend all day on each one of these, but just to highlight it, we are committed to a good neighbor policy and earning a social license. And that means we're not wading in there just because we have the right to be there, and just because it's designated for mining, we're not working on the assumption that that gives us any special status other than the right to invest our money and go through the permitting process. So we're trying to demonstrate to people that we are committed to doing this the right way. And it takes time to earn the trust of people in the region and the various stakeholders. It's easy to say things, but it's more important than saying them is doing them. And I've been encouraging everyone to compare our walk to our talk. And you will see after the first 3 years, 4 years of the project site, that we are walking the talk with respect to all of our commitments. Our local hire, for example, an Alaska hire, last year we had in excess of 600 employees working on the Pebble project. Now that includes people that we hired, that we have in our Anchorage office, people we hired at the site, and the employees that work with the consulting firms based in Alaska. More than 45 consulting firms on the environmental program alone, of which 65 or 70% of them are Alaskans. Commitment to local hire and Alaska content. I want to stress the environmental-driven design component of our resource policy. Gone are the days of the engineers designing a project, wrapping it in a red ribbon, and giving it to the permitting team and saying, get the permits yesterday because we want to build a mine. That's how they used to do it 20, 30, 40 years ago or more. Today, we impose on the engineering design team the environmental specialists, and they work in an integrated fashion. So the engineers can't do anything without it being vetted and approved by the environmental team that are involved in that process. And one example, Ken Brower's going to talk about how we selected the best location for a tailings facility by ranking it with the input of the fishery scientists like Dr. Buell and the wetland scientists and other environmental specialists. The no net loss to commercial sport and subsistence fisheries, that terminology has gotten me into trouble in a number of meetings. We've got a policy paper out on that that describes in detail what it is, but in essence it means that we will ensure that no fishery, be it commercial, sport, or subsistence fishery, will be compromised by our project. No fishery will be compromised by our project. Now, you may find that to be incredible, and you may not believe it, and I encourage that kind of skepticism. What I would ask you to do, though, is give us the benefit of the doubt, and give us the time to complete our studies, so that in the permitting process, the scientists and the engineers can demonstrate with empirical evidence why that can be achieved with our project, and by case studies to demonstrate how it's been achieved elsewhere in the world, and then formulate your opinion on whether you think we could fulfill that commitment. But it's kind of premature now to formulate an opinion on the achievability of that commitment when we haven't even designed our project or finished our environmental studies yet. But trust me, we wouldn't be spending $100+ million on this project to date and more and similar expenditures in the future if we weren't confident and optimistic because of the virtue of precedence and the science available and the engineering skills available. We wouldn't be investing that money unless we were convinced we could achieve that goal. Next. Funding for fisheries research. I guess we should focus on that. The Quijack River stocks have been, as you well know, very depressed in recent years. And through discussions with Trefon Magnuson and his associates, it became very clear to us that this was a serious problem. Now, the Quijack is not directly in the project area. It's not affected directly by our project. We are not influencing and have any effect on that decline the Quijack runs. But it became clear from the dialogue with Mr. Magnuson and with the Lake Peninsula Borough and the Alaska Department of Fish and Game that this was a serious issue. So I put my fisheries hat back on and said, well, you know, this is intriguing. We have world-class fisheries experts and funding for environmental studies. We, as a good neighbor, should contribute that in-kind confidence, capability, and knowledge to help, as a member of a cooperative approach, try to investigate and find out what the problem is with Quijack. So this last year, we were in a partnership mode with the Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation and the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, and we co-funded Northern Dynasty with those two bodies, co-funded an initial smolt out-migration study on the Quijack to start to collect the fisheries data to get a better understanding of what the productivity of that system is and what the factors may be that are contributing to the decline in the returns to that run. Now, it's a very complicated question, but we're starting to investigate that as members of this cooperative approach, and we're there for the long haul. I want to be completely honest and stress to you the two motivations we had for being involved in that. The first one was self-serving, and the second one was more altruistic. The self-serving one was, I knew that there would be certain parties in the region that would accuse Northern Dynasty down the road for being the cause of the Quijack River declines, even though the declines happened before we arrived. And so it's in my best interest as a company to participate in objective research to determine what the real causes were and to be able to demonstrate that it is not Northern Dynasty's presence that's causing that decline. The more altruistic reason was, because of my fisheries background and the intriguing discussions I've had with our consultants about this problem, and the desire to try to actually help and contribute and be a good neighbor. Next. Environmental studies, every discipline you can think of, and then some. These are just the chapter headings. There are volumes of study plans that are at least 2 feet thick by now for the last 3 years of studies. I won't go into any detail, but very thorough, very rigorous, very extensive by the A-team of consultants in Alaska. Next. This will give you a plan view picture of the project area. This is the deposit outline. And these are the drainages, the North Fork Kwaktuli flowing that way, South Fork Kwaktuli flowing that way, and Upper Tulare flowing this way. All of the dots and marks you see delineate a sampling location where various multidisciplinary environmental studies were done. And I won't go through all the detail. That would take all afternoon just to give you an overview of it. But the reason I want you to see the slide is it's very clear that there's extensive coverage with an incredible, phenomenal number of sampling stations for all the various disciplines to ensure we have a very good scientific understanding of the conditions of the site. Next. So to sum up, there are those who are ideologically opposed to the mine that would want you to believe that you have a choice to make, either the environment or a mine, and they are wrong. This isn't an opinion, this is a fact, and there are many precedents to demonstrate that you can have responsible mine development and at the same time that you can protect the environment. And I've just put a couple of pictures on here to give you an example of that. This is a designed controlled seepage pond at the toe of a tailings embankment in one of our sister company mines called Gibraltar Mine in central British Columbia. It's the third largest open pit copper mine in Canada. And this pond has trophy-sized rainbow trout that are sustained in this pond, and their metal levels in their tissue are equal to or less than the metal levels you find in control streams, not on the mine property. Contrary to what the propaganda that's being perpetuated in Alaska would lead you to believe, namely that there's a toxic soup behind the tailings embankment, this is tailings seepage that actually supports healthy fish. At the same mine site, you can see waste rock piles that have been graded here and haven't been seeded, but you're actually taking the picture from a revegetated, contoured waste rock pile. And deer and moose and other wildlife actually use this habitat after reclamation. There are examples of that in Alaska, all over North America, and around the world. In fact, problems at mines are the exception, not the rule. And they're typically associated with mines that are old and weren't permitted or designed or operated properly, or mines in third world countries where they don't have the stringent environmental standards and permitting requirements that we have in North America and in the state of Alaska. So you can have both. All I ask is give us the opportunity to prove it to you during the objective state and federal permitting process, which will take many years. Thank you.
Thank you, Bruce. Up next, we have on our agenda geochemistry. I believe Stephen Day will be giving a presentation on the chemical process of the mine. So, how about it, please?
Thanks, Jay. Just getting my presentation up here. Well, good afternoon, everybody. We're going to have a little bit of a change of gears here. I'm a technical specialist on the team. I'm a geologist by training, and I'm involved in predicting water quality at the site. So we have the next slide, please, Andy. So what I'm going to tell you about today is the studies and process that we're going through to ensure that this mine meets the water quality objectives. So I'm going to go through how the thinking that's changed about how water quality issues have changed over the years and how we handle them differently in modern times. I'm going to talk to you a bit about the experience that we've had at similar sites that gives us confidence that we can understand what's going on at Pebble. I'm then going to talk about something that I think many of you will have heard about, which is one of the big issues that mining companies have to deal with. It's called acid rock drainage.
I'm going to talk to you about that and how we go about preventing it. Next, please. Tell you a bit about what we know about acid rock draining potential at the Pebble project. And then we'll move to the recommendations that where my work links to the work that Ken Brower and Matt Peasold are doing on designing the mine. Next slide, please. So Bruce has already kind of mentioned this in his presentation towards the end, that if you look back sort of prior to the 1980s, mining, there's no doubt that most of the mining in the world was done with mainly with regard to just extracting the resource. And there wasn't a lot of thought given to protecting the environment and ensuring that water quality objectives were met. And that was a very bad thing, because not only were there concerns about the environment, but the issues that showed up with these old mines often showed up when the mines were closed down. And the mining company had gone and made their money, although these mines could be fixed to take away the problems of water quality, it becomes very expensive. It often gets funded out of the public purse, and so it's an issue for taxpayers. So bearing that in mind, and the fact that its closure is really the time when you start to see these concerns showing up, in the 1980s, there was this concept called designing for closure. And what designing for closure, the concept behind it was that when you're building your mine, let's build it today so that when the mine is closed and all the resources have been extracted and the mine is being returned to, it's being reclaimed, let's design it so that we don't have water quality issues or closure. And so this concept is called design for closure. So where I come in this project is that my involvement is to understand what kind of issues could show up through interaction of water with mine waste at the site, and how can we go about designing the project so we minimize those impacts and make sure that the project meets the water quality objectives. So what I do is I do various studies, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about those today, but not a whole lot. And I then tell the engineers, look, these are some of the things we have to deal with. These are some of the ways that we can make sure that we meet water quality objectives. And they then go and they factor that into their mine design. And you're going to hear from Ken Brower about that a bit later. Now, that's not where it ends. What happens is that then Ken comes to me and he says, well, we've done these designs. Tell me about what the water quality is going to be like. And I then take a look at it and I do water quality predictions. And I determine whether that design is going to meet the objective of satisfying water quality objectives. I look at water quality residual effects as well. What's left over after the measures will be implemented. And I say to Ken, well, Ken, there's something that's not. This isn't good enough. And what happens is we hit the button. We then feedback and we take another look at the design. And it's basically an iterative process. And I can honestly say that this is one of the most satisfying projects for me professionally, because this is what's happened on this project. I've sat through many engineering meetings only to have questions asked of me as to whether the designs that are being put forward will meet water quality objectives. So it's been a very good project that way. And in fact, I don't say unique in the level of involvement that I've had in it. So next slide, please. Just tell you a little bit about myself. My name is Steve Day. I'm the project geochemistry lead. I'm a registered professional geoscientist in British Columbia. I have 17 years experience working in this this aspect of the mining industry. And I've looked at 15 similar sites throughout the Americas. And when I say similar, I mean geologically similar and also similar from a mining standpoint. And I've also got a fair bit of Alaskan experience too. You can see that I've worked at Red Dog Mine, at Pogo Project and Fort Knox Mine. I don't just work for mining companies, I'm also contracted by government departments. For the Fort Knox Mine, I didn't work for Kinross, I worked for the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation as a reviewer. I've done the same thing for projects in Canada. I worked for federal and provincial departments, basically to ensure that the work that other consultants have done is meeting the objective of the studies. The next. So this is just a list of the organizations that I've worked for. The last organization on the list there is the MEND program, which is it's a Canadian federal program that was instituted in the 1980s when this design for closure concept came forward, where a great deal of research has been done on looking particularly at metal leaching and acid rock drainage from mine sites. Next slide, please. This is a map of British Columbia, and the reason that I put this up here is to show you that there are a large number of mineral deposits in Western North America that are very similar to pebble. These deposits are called porphyry deposits, and they're basically, as Bruce has said, they're large, low-grade copper, molybdenum, gold deposits. And the ability to mine these only really showed up really, I guess, maybe in the 50s and 60s when the technology to mine them became available. And as a result of that, a lot of work was done looking at the potential for these deposits. They're very attractive economically, as Bruce has explained. But all these dots on here are examples of deposits, mineral deposits, which are very similar to pebble. And these are all the names of them here. Next button, please. These red dots are all the ones that my company, SRK, has been involved in. Some of them are mines. In fact, most of them are mines. Some of them are deposits that have been looked at and haven't proceeded to mining. And I guess I'm being a bit coy here, I say SRK experience, but actually personally, I've been involved in just about every single one of these red dots. So that should give you some comfort that there's a great deal of experience available about this type of mineral deposit. The fact that many of them have been mined also helps us to understand how to go about mining pebble and how to go about protecting the environment around pebble. So there's a lot of experience, and we knew that that experience was available and we could apply it to pebble. So we're not starting something new here from a geological standpoint. We really are working on something that there's an awful lot of experience about that dates back to the 60s. Okay, so that's a little bit of background on the geological type. But now I'm going to move to explain to you a bit about this acid rock drainage that I'm sure that many of you have heard about. And I want to just start off by explaining that although acid rock drainage is something that's definitely associated with mine deposit with mining, and in fact it used to be called acid mine drainage, it's actually a natural process. And the reason I've got these pictures up here is just to show you that acid rock drainage doesn't need mining to happen. These are two pictures from the Red Dog Mine in Alaska. And these are natural streams that flow through the Red Dog deposit area before Red Dog was mined. And you don't have to look too hard to see a big orange stain here. There's some water coming out of the Red Dog deposit here and flowing into the stream. And you can see it's clear here, and then it becomes orange down here. And this is natural acid rock drainage. Acid rock drainage is basically a weak form of sulfuric acid, and the orange you see there is rust. It's iron that's coming out of the water. Another point that is interesting about Red Dog is that the water, the natural water flowing through the deposit, was unsuitable for fish. There were no fish there. And in fact, since the mine started there, they've actually improved the water quality in the creek. Next slide, please. So I'm now going to just give you a little bit of a chemistry lesson here. And I'm using chemist. I have to find this very straightforward, and I hope that I can explain it to you in a way that you understand. But acid rock, the generation of acid rock drainage is basically a chemical process. And it starts with a mineral that some of you may have heard of called iron pyrite, or that the old timers called it fool's gold, because sometimes they would see pyrite and think they had gold. And you can see that it's what we call an iron sulfide, it's a combination of iron and sulfur. Next slide, please. So now what I'm going to do is just through a sort of cartoon here, is explain to you about how acid rock drainage originates. So what I show here is a cube of iron pyrite that's was buried in the ground. Now it's been taken out of the ground, but it could be by mining, it could be by natural formation of talus. basically this is a cube of iron pyrite that's been pulled out of the ground. What happens, that when it gets exposed to the environment, the agents of the atmosphere start to act on it. And the big one is oxygen from the air starts to attack the iron pyrite grain. We also have water from the air as well, humidity. And also there's a bacteria that feeds on iron pyrite. Its name is Thiobacillus, and it basically gets its energy from oxidizing sulfur and iron. But this is ubiquitous, and it attacks the iron pyrite. Next, please. So what happens is that this grain of pyrite, when its agents act on it, it starts to get, we see a white crust growing on it, and I actually would have brought a piece of this with me today, but I wasn't sure if I could get it through the security system of the airport, so I left it at home. But if you get a piece of pyrite and leave it on your desk or just leave it outside, you get these little sort of white crystals that start to grow on it, and they form a little kind of dusting of white on it. Next slide, please. And what happens is, hit the next button, please. When water comes along in the form of precipitation, it dissolves that white crust of salt that's formed on the mineral, and it forms acid rock drainage. And so that mineral is dissolved, and it's made, the components of it have gone into solution, and these are the components that end up in solution. This is basically acid rock drainage. An important aspect of this is that the process is what we call exothermic, which means that it actually makes heat. So if you have enough of this, you can actually feel heat coming off it through the reaction. Yeah, please. Iron sulfide is not pure. Pure pyrite isn't pure iron sulfide. It may also contain other elements. Copper, nickel, and arsenic would be examples. So when this process goes on, bleaching of water, bleaching of salt, we also get these other metals coming into solution as well. So that's acid rock drainage. Next slide. So if that was the end of the story, actually the mountains of the world would be running with acid rock drainage, because pyrite is a very common mineral. It's very easy to find. It varies in quantity. But if you take a rock hammer and bash a piece of rock off almost anywhere in the world, you'll often find a little bit of pyrite in it. But the acid that's formed from oxidation from that doesn't always manifest itself as acid rock drainage. And the reason for that is that there are minerals that naturally neutralize the acid in acid rock drainage. And one of them is calcite. Its chemical formula is calcium carbonate. For those of you who aren't familiar with this is the component of antacids that you can take for stomach acid. So it's calcium carbonate. And the result of that... Thanks, please. Okay, by the time we're done, we'll nod and you'll look down. The result of that is that the acid that was produced in from the previous slide contacts the mineral, and some of the acid goes away. And also at the same time, some of the metals go away as well. So this is an important natural process, which basically means that just because we have sulfide oxidizing doesn't mean that we also have acid forming because of this mineral calcite and some other minerals like it. So understanding this process, if you can understand the process, you can understand the kinds of things that we want to do to stop it. And so I'm now going to step you through the kinds of technological ideas that people have been working with probably since the late 1970s and into the 80s. And so we start with all these processes and we say, what can we do to basically stop the process from happening and stop the water quality impacts? The main thing that we want to do is to stop the formation of acidity. Because if we can stop the acidity forming, then we can basically slow down this whole process and make it so that the metals, which are the main thing we're concerned about from a water quality standpoint, to make sure that they don't become an issue. So just stepping through this, what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through and reverse the things the things that don't work very well and up to the things that work really well. The first one that people have looked at is to cool the reaction down. So try and take away heat, because heat makes chemical reactions go faster. So we can get rid of the heat, you can slow this down. Next, please. Something else that's been looked at was to apply chemicals that will kill off the bacteria that work to make this reaction go. chemicals have been developed to do this. They're not widely used. There are quite a lot of issues with them. One of them is you apply the chemical and then it washes away and doesn't, you don't have it anymore. The process restarts. The bacteria are very hardy. Second one is that you're applying a chemical. So you've got rid of one chemical problem and you're potentially applying another chemical problem. Moving up the list here, the next big one that we often look at is to say, well, if we can cut off the flow of water over this pyrite ring, we can basically cut off this so that the crystal would stay there, so we can cut off the water. Maybe that could be done with, it could be by putting a cover material over the waste so that the water can't contact the waste. Next slide, please. And I'm going to finish with the really big one, which is to cut off the supply of oxygen. If we can do this, we can very effectively stop this whole process from happening. And this is the one that technologically, if you can do it, is the very best to do. It's also the one that's most easily applied prior to mining and when you're designing the mine. And basically, there are a number of different approaches that have been tried for this one. The big one that works really well is to take the material that has the pyrite in it and put it under water. Now, all you folks are, many of you involved in fisheries work, and you probably know, well, of course, there's oxygen in water. Why does that work? It turns out that the amount of oxygen that can dissolve in water is not enough, anywhere near enough, to make this reaction go. It's a little tiny bit of oxygen. The fish are very good at using that little bit of oxygen, but pyrite is not that efficient. It needs a lot more oxygen than is in water to accomplish that. So we can accomplish effectively shutting down this process by basically making sure that the material that has the pyrite in is covered by water. And that can be done by simply by having a water layer on top of the material, or it can be done by surrounding in the material that actually acts like a sponge and soaks up water and has the same effect. So you can do it both ways. So that's really the Cadillac, the thing you really want to aim for. Next slide, please. Some of the other things that can be done is that you can do something about the acidity once it's formed, and that's not attractive to do that, because once you've got the problem, then you have to run a treatment plant and you have to do something about that water. But it works. It does make sure that if you run a water treatment plant, you can be sure of meeting water quality objectives. Next, please. And so you're basically doing the same thing as calcite. You're getting rid of the acidity, precipitating the metals. And it's a very, very certain technology. It's done all over the world, lots of examples. Now, just to kind of conclude on this section on what you can do about acid rock drainage, what we usually recommend is not to do just one thing, but to have a layer of approaches, things that you do layer upon layer, so that you're not relying on one technology to make sure you meet water quality objectives, but you're applying a lot of different things. And that philosophy is applied to all the projects that we work on. Next slide, please. So now that you've got some background on acid rock drainage, I'm going to tell you what do we know about acid rock drainage potential at Pebble. Next, please. Now, you've already seen a section a bit like this that Bruce showed you. And just to remind you, this is really a cross cut or a slice through the ground that you would see if you could slice the area of the Pebble deposit. The area of the mineralization, you'll recognize this, the same kind of features on this diagram. Just to sort of explain to you, this is kind of an old slide that really shows the west deposit, but doesn't tell you anything about Pebble East, which is over here. But these lines that you see on here are the drill holes that the Golden Dynasty have put in the ground, and the little sort of bars along it show you the grade of copper and gold that have been found in the rock along those drill holes. So trying to explain to you how the Pebble deposit forms is an important part of understanding where we come from in designing the project. The mineralization basically formed underneath the volcano. And underneath the volcano, you've got molten rock, and the molten rock causes water to circulate through the ground. And that water as it circulates gets hot, dissolves the minerals, and makes them precipitate, and forms the area of the mineralization. So that's what's going on, that's what went on hundreds of millions of years ago in the ground beneath the volcano, the area of the Pebble deposit is. Now, sometime in the, around about 65 million years ago, or sometime after that, The whole area was uplifted and became mountains, almost eroded and formed a soil layer. And then on top of that was placed this green, sort of what looks like a wedge here. This would have been land at one point, and then a whole different set of rocks was deposited on top of the pebble mineralization. It's very important to understand that because this really affects particularly the astronaut trace characteristics of this deposit. This area is mineralized. It was affected by the circulating hot waters underneath the volcano. This material, this rock, was deposited long after the volcano had gone and the whole area had become mountains again and was eroded and deposited on top of it. So the difference is that this rock has minerals in it, the minerals that Northern Dynasty is interested in, and also pyrite. These rocks have very little pyrite in them and have quite different characteristics when we come to look at acid rock drainage. Now the thing that was really important for me when I first started looking at this project was that this wasn't the first time I'd seen this. I'd seen lots of examples of the same type of geology through the other types of porphyries that I'd looked at through British Columbia, through Yukon, through Washington, and down into South America. So it was very, very similar. I knew that there were some familiar and similar characteristics that I could follow on from. Next slide, please. This is really just to illustrate the amount of work that's been done to understand the rock that's in the area of the pebble deposit. And don't worry too much about these lines on here. These were some of the earlier ideas about the limits of an open pit in the Pebble West, Cove West deposit. Each of these little dots represents a drill hole that Northern Dynasty and companies that worked on this project before drilled in the ground to understand the geology and also to understand the chemistry of the rock. And the bigger dots are places that we've collected samples for the studies that I'm involved in as well. But what this should just give you an impression of is that a huge amount of drilling and work has gone on to understand the geology of this deposit. Just to give you an example, and of course the numbers have gone from my head, but the Northern Dynasty has analyzed, I think, in excess of 14,000 rock samples from the Pebble deposit to understand the geology and the mineralization. And the number of holes that they drilled, I blanked on, I think it's around about 250. So, it's now more than 500. Okay, thank you. That's a lot of holes. It should give you some confidence that a lot of work has been put into understanding the geology of this deposit. Next slide, please. So basically from this geology information that the Northern Dynasty and the predecessor companies collected, we went ahead and we were asked by Northern Dynasty to design a test or a characterization program that would help us understand acid rock drainage in particular, because it was known from all the experience at other porphyries that acid rock drainage could be a concern for a mining porphyry deposit. We went through this process of designing what we call a geochemical characterization program. And this is just a couple of words here to illustrate to you the kind of tests that we do. They have fancy names that we use in this field, but the first type of test is called a static test. And what this does is basically a test that's done on the rock to look at whether it has the potential to generate acid or leach metals. Now I say potential, that's an important part of it, because what it is saying to us is there a concern that this material, if it wasn't managed properly, would make acid? Would it leach metals? We can then use that information to consider how we can stop it from doing that. But the first test, the static test, tells us what that potential is. The second type of testing we do is called kinetic testing. This is basically what we call a weathering test, where we actually look at how the material will perform. And some of the testing is done, to look at what would happen if it wasn't managed properly, and other testing to look at different kinds of technologies that we can apply. So we're looking, the kinetic testing is basically telling us what kind of rate or how fast things would happen. So these are the kind of tests that we've done, and we've done hundreds of these types of tests, and we keep doing more as we as the project understanding and the deposit increases, and we've done lots of these types of tests as well. Now what I'd like to tell you is that the Northern Dynasty's instructions to me were, do what needs to be done. Like, do what you need to do to understand this, because we want to make sure that this project is designed to address acid rock drainage. And so that's what I did. And I think that should give you some confidence, because if you came to me and asked me, Steve, would you design a characterization program to consider this issue, you would have got the same design. It's got nothing to do with whether I was working for Melbourne Dynasty. It's the program that needs to be done. And the program that we've done is consistent with all, or if not better, than the kinds of programs that have been done for aluminum deposits. So it's a very state-of-the-art program. We've applied new things that we've learned over the years for other projects. Next slide, please. This is just a picture of some of the kinetic tests, and you can see that they're, these doesn't show very well, but these little plastic columns, they have rock inside them, and they help us to understand how the rock would behave when it's on the surface. Next slide, please. So what have we learned? And I didn't explain one thing on the geologist slide, but we talk about the pre-tertiary rocks. This refers to the age of the rocks, which are mineralized rocks, the ones that Northern Dynasty are most interested in. What we found was that those mineralized rocks, that the majority of them have the potential to generate ARD. So that was a finding from the study we did. This feeds in and says that these wastes that are produced from this material would need to be managed to prevent acid rock drainage. This is not a surprise to me. When I started looking at this project the first time, I expected this answer to come back. When we got the results back, I said, yeah, that's what we expected. So not surprising. Next slide, please. That green wedge of material that sits on top that we call the cover rock or a tertiary age rock, we found out that that was generally not potentially acid rock drainage. Did not have the potential to generate acid rock drainage. Again, this wasn't surprising. We found this at other projects we've worked at, the rock that overlies the mineralized area often has this characteristic. It has very little pyrite, but it often has a lot of calcite in it, that mineral that neutralizes acid. Next slide, please. So the conclusion was that those rocks did not need to be managed to prevent acid rock drainage. Next slide, please. Looking at tailings, and tailings are the leftovers from crushing up the rock to get the economic minerals from the ore. And the metallurgists, the people that work on understanding how to get the ore, to get the minerals out of the ore, they've designed a process that basically produces two tailings streams. And I can't give you the details of that, but it turns out that the production of these two tailings streams presented an excellent opportunity to manage to prevent acid rock drainage. And what we discovered was that 95%, one of the tailing streams, which represents 95% of the tailings, does not have the potential to generate ARD. So that's fantastic. That basically means that of the mass of tailings material, 95% of it doesn't have any concern with acid rock drainage, and that makes managing it a lot more straightforward. There is a small component, roughly 5% of the tailings, which are potentially acid rock drainage generating. And that means that we need to do something about that. The project needs to be designed to address that potential. But it's 5%, so it's a lot smaller material. In the old days, the mill would have just simply combined these two streams together. It turns out when you mix these two together, the whole thing becomes acid rock drainage generating. And so you'd have an awful lot of tailings to manage to prevent ARD. In this case, we can manage only 5%, and we can address the whole potential for ARD. Next slide, please. So this is we've come full circle now, and we're in the last couple of slides, I think, here. I'm not an engineer. I'm a geochemist. I do these water quality predictions. I then go to Ken, who's going to talk to you next. And I made recommendations to him about what is the best management approach for the materials that will be produced. Next slide, please. And the recommendation was that the waste rock that is associated with the ore, what we call the pre-tertiary waste rock, that it needs to be disposed in a permanently saturated condition. So we're keeping the oxygen out so that that rock will not produce acid rock drainage. So that was a direction to Ken's company. Next slide, please. The second thing was that we knew there was a component of the tailings, 5% of the tailings roughly, that also had the same recommendation, permanent saturated disposal. So there's no potential for acid rock drainage to be produced now or in the future. Next slide, please. We also found that that green wedge of rock, the cover materials, the rock that isn't mineralized, is actually non-reactive. It has no potential for acid rock drainage generation. And it's suitable for construction purposes. And that's really important for Ken and his company, because they need construction materials. And they can use this rock, most of it, for construction purposes. Next slide. And finally, the last point was that 95% components of the tailings that has no potential for ARD, that those tailings can be beached. And what that means is that they can be disposed in a dry form. They don't need to have a water cover over them or something to prevent acid rock drainage. Next slide, please. So that hopefully has given you a bit of background. I know that my area can be rather technical, but maybe it's, I'll give you a little bit of a snapshot of it today anyway.
I think we'll take a 5-minute break before we get on. We have two more presentations to attend.
As we've indicated, it's going to change again once we update your reserves. We started off with a very initial study. It was a preliminary engineering study. We had 15 different components of our project, buildings alternatives, if you like, laid out all over different locations on the site. I'll show you those. We narrowed it down on the basis of those engineering studies to a few, but we very quickly sat down with the environmental team and really selected three of those, which on a broad sense deemed were suitable for further study. And of those three, we had a detailed environmental look at the environmental considerations and kind of focused in on one, which was 15, which was a broad concept. We then optimized that particular concept and split it into six other ones. So we had 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20. Sat down with the environmental team again, looked at some of the critical issues and all the environmental considerations that were relevant to each one of those. We refined those again, came up with three more. We then did some additional optimization studies and kept on tweaking those. We layered on additional engineering and environmental considerations, and the project was changing at this point in time as well. The resource was getting nailed down a bit more. We were zeroing in on some additional options. And then we refined that again to come up with five sort of preferred options, which satisfied the criteria that we were looking for both the engineering and the environmental team, and then zeroed in on the best option of those. Okay, next slide, please. So this slide, it's quite confusing, but it illustrates some of the different concepts, and they're layered on top of each other, as you can see. There's the upper Tularic, South Fork, Montuli, North Fork over here. There's the deposit area right in the middle. So we basically looked at anything that had the capacity and the size to deal with the tailings and waste management that we were contemplating at the site. We also looked at an option that contemplated disposal of tailings in the lake, okay, in the deep part of the lake itself. Next slide. So through the process, and this is a Reader's Digest version, if you like, of the process, but we eliminated a lot of those options for a variety of reasons, including the lake option. We were directed and by the environmental team in Notre Dame Dynasty to avoid the Tular Creek, the North Fork Pachtuli, the lower reaches of the South Fork Pachtuli, et cetera, for a variety of reasons, not the least of which were considerations on aquatic resources. Okay, so this illustrates some of the shortlisting of those initial 15 through 20. Okay, so there's five or six different options illustrated in here, concentrated on the top part of the South Fork Pachtuli and around the Brightman Lake near the open pit, as well as what we call Area G. Next. And as we refined our designs and our discussions with the environmental team, we're basically avoiding the stream courses as much as we can. So we're looking at several different options here. We call them 18B, 19B, and 20B. You see the common theme is Site G, around the Brightman Lake area and the upper part of the South Fork Pachtuli. Next. This has been a refinement, called 21 through 25. You may have noticed that in this last slide, we also saw the pit expand slightly. At this point in time, the exploration geologist actually gave us revised, updated numbers on the resource. And so we had to contend with more materials. It was actually a benefit at that time in the process, because you can see it moved a bit towards the east, and in moving towards the east and getting into some of these higher grade, deeper ores, it also meant that we were creeping into those tertiary sediments, the good rock that Steve was talking about earlier. We had more of that available, and that was a bonus or a benefit for us, because we then had more construction materials to do what we needed to do with these various components. Next. So all of those options were narrowed down through numerous discussions with the environmental team, and we ended up with this particular configuration, which is what we call NDC-25. And I'm going to show you a little bit more information on the stage development of that particular option as we get into the rest of the slides here. Okay. But the mine development concepts that we went through, we really did follow an integrated team approach. Really, this is a checklist that kind of put together at the end to summarize many of the things that we looked at. key considerations of avoid environmentally sensitive watersheds, and the environmental team were instrumental in guiding the engineering team in allowing us to determine where those areas were and then come up with concepts that avoided those. So we were looking for the least sensitive parts of the least sensitive watersheds in order to design our facilities in those particular areas. We also, at Steve's recommendation, looked at keeping the pyritic tailings separate from the rest of the tailings. We could keep that encapsulated in the pond, keep it flooded to prevent it from generating acid rock drainage, as per those recommendations. Similarly, that potentially reactive waste rock that was going to be generated in the open pit development, we collectively decided that the best solution for that was to place that in the tailings impoundment as well. So it's it is encapsulated with the non-reactive tailings and also covered with water so that it cannot oxidize and won't produce acid rock drainage either. We minimized the mine footprint. There is some advantage to that in terms of avoiding environmentally sensitive areas. And so we deliberately tried to avoid those areas, and in so doing, we increased the height in some of the facilities to avoid spreading the materials out over a larger area. Non-reactive waste rock is the construction material that, using those materials out of the open pit, allowed us to avoid having to develop separate external borrow areas and, of course, reduce the disturbance that would be associated with those external borrow areas. So we came up with sort of an integrated development plan which utilized the materials that were available from the mine development to the maximum extent. We also looked at site water balance for all these options in order to keep a close eye on the water management aspects as well, because the solids management and the water management go hand in hand in these alternative assessments. And of course, one of the things that we always consider whenever we're looking at any particular option is an integrated concept which allows us to consider closure and reclamation right from the start. Okay, we're going to talk quickly now about some of the site characteristics. All of these are very important considerations to the design, operation, construction of the tailings impoundment. So we'll touch base quickly on climate, hydrometeorology, hydrology, hydrogeology, where the geotechnical investigations have been done, seismicity, spend a little time talking about that, as well as water quality, and Steve has already touched base on that. So we'll go through some of these fairly quickly, but let's hit the next slide, please. As Bruce mentioned, there's a number of Alaskan consultants that have been assisting on this, and they're providing the information to the engineering team on these components. The slide on the upper left is just installation of one of the hydrometeorology sites. There's actually three of them on site right now, and I think plans for even more. The picture on the right is just an indication of some of the snowpack surveys. The snow accumulations, etc., are also keen. But we'll have 5 minutes left. Okay, next slide, please. Hydrology. They did lots of hydrology testing, studies, detailed labor-intensive studies in the streams throughout the project area. Next, please. Hydrogeology, same thing. In the boreholes, testing, monitoring of water levels and testing permeabilities, etc., and reclamation and seeding of the sites afterwards. Next, please. Geotechnical investigations, lots. There's the open pit there. There were test pits excavated throughout the site to look at superficial materials, extensive drilling programs, geotechnical drilling. Also, these red lines illustrate seismic surveys. These are also provide the engineers with information on the depth of overburden and the characteristics of that overburden, where the bedrock is, and where the groundwater table is as well. So extensive geotechnical investigations. Next, please. Water quality studies. Steve already touched base on these. Obviously, there's lots of baseline studies being conducted, but there was also quite a bit of work done by folks like SRK in coming up with predictions of what they city. And I've got a few slides on seismicity here just to illustrate what has been done to date at the site. These studies are continuing. Alaska seismicity is from two main sources. Okay. And I'm going to show you some photos of these in a minute, but there's one source zone which is called the Aleutian Megathrust. Okay. These are continental plates which are banging into each other, and one is actually sliding or subducting under the other plate. And when it slides under that other plate, it creates earthquakes. Very large earthquakes can be generated along these subducting plates. The 1964 earthquake that caused damage in Anchorage is one of these types of earthquakes. Earthquakes are also caused by geologic faults. So major active faults, which we call crustal features, happen when there's slippage in the Earth's crust, and these can also cause very large earthquakes. One of those occurred in 2002, what we call the Denali Fault. That was a magnitude 7.9. Project location, in the box here, the yellow star, this is where the project is, there's Lake Iliamna. This is just a blow-up of that project location. What you see is the project is a little ways away from some of these source zones. Okay, and these red dots, each one of those red dots represents a seismic event, an earthquake. You see there's not many red dots right at the site. They're a ways away, and some of them are on the faults, and some of them are related to this Aleutian Megathrust zone. Okay. This is U.S. Geologic Survey map. What U.S. Geological Survey does is takes all of those red dots, all of that earthquake activity, and provides various maps to aid designers in coming up with appropriate seismic design parameters to use for buildings, structures, dams, etc. Project location, again, it's in the box here. This is that megathrust zone off the coast that we talked about where large earthquakes. You can see this red line over here where the magnitude 7.9 is. That's the Denali earthquake. Okay. We look at all of those things, and they predict what they call ground motion acceleration at different locations within the state. The Pebble project is based on the USGS survey, predicted to have an acceleration, an intensity of shaking of 0.25 G. That's 25% of gravity. But engineers use it as a relative indication of the relative magnitude of the shaking when you design appropriately for it. Next, please. This is just a little bit better illustration, if you like, of what I've been talking about, these subducting plates, okay, these megathrust earthquakes. So you've got this oceanic crust which is sliding underneath this crust over here, and as a result, you get earthquakes generated. You also can have volcanic activity generated from that process as well. So in this case, the Pacific plate is subducting under the North American plate. And high earthquake frequency occurs. You get lots of earthquakes due to that process. And you can get very large ones. This is where the magnitude 9 or 9 plus events can occur. Next, please. The other ones, the shallow crustal ones, these occur further in on the continent and result in slippage along these geologic faults. This illustrates just the slippage. The direction can be up or down or sideways, but when that slippage occurs, it results in a lot of energy and shaking, and that is the source of the earthquakes. It's hard to see with this light, but this is one of those faults which has occurred on a road, and there's a vertical drop here, which is characteristic of this particular type of fault displacement. Okay. The faults that we have in Alaska and near the project site are the Denali, which is quite a ways away, and the Castle Mountain, which is a bit closer to the site and actually results in one of the more critical earthquakes that the engineers have to consider for design. Next, please. This then illustrates how those potential earthquake sources will influence the design at the Pebble site. So the mine site schematically is shown here, over on top of the continental crust. These earthquakes that occur because of these megathrust events are quite a ways away, 125 miles away. Okay. The shallow crustal ones, i.e. the Castle Mountain Fault, is much closer. It's in the order of 18 miles away. And even though it's a smaller magnitude event, it's magnitude 7.8, because it's closer, it could, can result in a higher intensity of shaking at the site. Next, please. This illustrates that concept. The mine site's here and way over in the subduction zone at the megathrust, we get a magnitude 9.2, which is the maximum earthquake that can conceivably occur out there. The seismologists do those calculations, but that's the biggest earthquake that can occur out at that particular location. And this is a representation of how the peak ground acceleration decreases with distance. Obviously, the further away you are away from the earthquake epicenter, the less you feel the intensity from that earthquake. But a very large earthquake, you can still feel it quite a ways away. The attenuation of that shaking is a lot slower than it is for an earthquake, a smaller earthquake. This smaller earthquake is on the Castle Mountain Fault, magnitude 7.8, so it's a lot closer to the site, only 18 miles away. You can see that that shaking is also attenuated, but it results in a higher higher PGA, ground acceleration at the site. So that smaller earthquake is actually more critical in terms of the magnitude or degree of shaking that is occurring on the site. Next, please. Okay, this is some research that we did. We actually got this from a paper prepared by a fellow named Jim Swaysgood. It's a summary of earthquakes in an unexpected region. You can go to the next slide. There's about 69 on this list and counting technique. So this is 2003. Okay. These are for earth-fill, rock-fill dams, similar in construction method and composition, if you like, as to what is being contemplated for the Pebble site. So there's 69 of these structures which have been subjected to various degrees of earthquake intensity. Next slide, please. Those 69 embankments are plotted on this figure. And the different types of embankments, this is the concrete face rock fill dam, earth core rock fill dam, hydraulic fill, earth fill, those different types of structures are also plotted on there. The peak ground acceleration is used as the measure of the degree of shaking that each one of those dams felt at the site. And you can see that from the previous slides, we were talking about something in the order of 0.3 G for the pebble structure based on the earthquake studies that have been done. It would fall right in the middle. And on the left-hand side is an indication of the potential settlement of these structures. The point that is made by Swaysgood, which is very important to understand, is dams that are constructed by these methods don't fail. These are all of the structures that he found that have been subjected to earthquakes. And basically, the conclusion that he came to is dams constructed by these methods from active earthfill, rockfill, etc., are inherently stable in even very, very large seismic events. You've got some up here that are extremely high seismicity in the 0.72 range. His fundamental conclusion was that you can get a little bit of deformation. Basically, you shake the embankment really hard with the earthquake, it can spread a bit, and the crest may settle a tiny bit, and the slopes may actually bulge out a little bit, but you don't see failure. None of these embankments has resulted in failure, which results in loss of the content. Next, please. Okay. Mine development concept 25, then. Next, please. We'll show you very quickly what we've done previously, and of course, we're waiting for additional information. Okay. First of all, Steve mentioned the different materials that are coming out of the open pit. Okay, of the concept we looked at was about 4.3 billion tons. 58% of that goes through the mill, results in tailings. We store that inside the impoundment. The rest is waste rock. Some of that waste rock also goes in there. Thanks to reactive rock, about 17% of the total also goes inside the impoundment because we want to store it securely. Non-reactive waste rock is used to build the embankments. Next, please. This is just an illustration of those different materials. The vast majority of the tailings materials are non-reactive and good for encapsulated materials. Very small amount of carbonic material, which goes inside, which is managed separately. The waste rock, potentially reactive, goes inside, managed separately. This material is used for embankment construction. Next, please. Okay. New Bedford, there's many things I can show here, but running out of time, but you're getting additional construction. We build some starter embankments. This is during construction. We stockpile topsoil and overburden materials, and we're going to save those materials for use in reclamation exposure. During pre-stripping, those materials are used as the construction materials. Any potential reactive waste rock actually goes inside even during pre-production, so it can be stored within the embankment. We've got a mill site. Pressure, you get a conveyor system, and you get pipelines for sure in the process of being constructed next to. So let's start up. Your pipelines are now constructed. You can see them, they extend on the embankments. You've got potentially reactive waste rock, and here you've captured enough water at startup to allow the mill to get up and running because water is needed in the milling process. You've got tailings lines, which are going to discharge tailings. You've got replanted pumps, which pump that water and recirculate it back into process. Next, please. As the operations continue, obviously the pit gets bigger and the impoundment starts to fill. So after 5 years of operation, you'll see these are what we call sandy tailings beaches. So we're discharging sandy and silty tailings materials. They literally develop beaches along the front of the embankments, and the pond situated on top of those sandy and silty materials, and it's continuously recycled back to the mill. You see there's a separate pipeline right here. That's where the primary tailings is going. It's being discharged underwater, so it remains covered with water throughout the operations to prevent acid generation from occurring. Similarity to the waste rock, the same thing is occurring. Our topsoil stockpiles, we're collecting and saving that material throughout the operation for use in closure reclamation. Next, please. Same sort of thing. It just gets bigger as years go by and tailings and waste rock are placed in there. The impoundment expands until we reach the final arrangement. Okay. So what we're going to show next is a section, which just is a skewed section. It runs through the mill site, down through the pit, and into the tailings impoundment to illustrate some of the other concepts. Next, please. Okay. So there's the mill site. There's the very large open pit. There's the tailings embankments with waste rock, gravitic tailings, and of course the non-reactive tailings, which is the bulk of the material. And you can see this blue line right at the top, which is the extent of the water in that pond. It's basically a perfect pond, which varies in depth, but and it varies in depth because location as well as time of operation. But in this particular slide, it's in the order of 75 feet deep, perched on top of this extensive thickness of sandy and silty materials and rock. Next, please. This zeroes in on it a little bit more. Okay, so the tailings impoundment gradually becomes this very large mound of fine silt, sand, and rock with this 75-foot plus or minus pond perched on top of it. Potentially reactive rock and gravitic tailings are encapsulated in those materials. Next, please. This is just a zoom in on the embankment. These embankments are very high. They vary from 700 to 740 feet high in this particular concept. And you can see they are built in stages. So we start with a fairly small dam and they're progressively raised. That's what these lines indicate. And as these materials are built from the open pit, it is progressively expanded as required to store the tailings, which is progressively generated throughout the life of the operation. Next, please. Water management. Okay. Stormwater management and water balance, two very important considerations. Next, please. One point to mention here is where this impoundment sits. There's the open pit, there's the tailings impoundment. These are the limits of what we call the catchment area boundaries. It's basically the mountaintops around there. So water flowing on this side of that particular boundary flows down the Tulare. Water on this side flows down the South Fork Coquitlam. You can see that we're situated right up at the top of this catchment area. So the water that falls on the site is basically direct precipitation. There's not a lot of catchment above the site that we have to be concerned with. Next, please. What we do to manage those large storm events that we design for during operations are provide what we call freeport. So we always allow for enough space to contain the maximum storm event that's conceivably possible at the site. we design adequate freeboard into these impoundments so that we always have room to store it, the maximum flood event. We call it the probable maximum flood. It's the largest event that's conceivably possible at the site. And on top of that, we provide additional freeboard as a safety margin. Thank you. Water balance. There's a lot of arrows on this particular slide. There's a lot of information that is used to evaluate the water balance for something, for a site like this. Each of these arrows is a component that we specifically study in route, depending on the water chemistry, et cetera. So site-wide water balance considers all of the different flow components, including groundwater coming into the open pit, precipitation on the plant site, tailings going into the facility, reclaimed water going back into the process, clean runoff that's diverted around the facilities, clean runoff that ends up going into the facilities, et cetera, seepage recycle measures. All of these things are illustrated on this, and it's a schematic representation of a very detailed analysis that is done for these particular projects. Next, please. Okay, one of the key considerations in terms of water management is coming to terms with what the water quality is, and in particular, designing that water quality to be as clean as possible. You saw this slide earlier. Bruce showed that his presentation is the Gibraltar Proper Mine. This is not, so this is pretty characteristic of what we would expect the water quality to be like at the Tumble Mine. Similarly, this is a picture of the Fort Knox mine. It's actually a freshwater reservoir, which is downstream of the tailings impoundment. That's the tailings impoundment up there. And each of these particular sites has got very good examples of thriving fish populations immediately downstream. Next, please. Closure reclamation considerations. Next. This is a schematic illustration of what the tailings impoundment could look like after closure for this NDC 25 concept. You see the north embankment here, the main embankment. All of the outer slopes would be covered with topsoil and revegetated. The sandy beaches around the facility would be covered, first of all, with a layer of waste rock, then a layer of topsoil, and then revegetated with appropriate vegetation species. The shoreline would actually be modified as appropriate based on discussions with local communities and government authorities in order to develop an approved contained use plan. But there's a lot of flexibility in what we can do in terms of beach and shoal areas, et cetera, for these lakes that would be present at the end of operations. And ultimately, obviously, the thing needs to be stable in perpetuity. And it's got to meet these end land use objectives over time. Next, please. This is the last slide, and it just provides an indication of what can be done with tailings impoundments, particularly when we have good water quality. This is an operation which I think Jim Buell will talk a little bit more on. He's the fish expert. This is a project in British Columbia, which converted their tailings pond into a trophy trout fishery, which they allow people to fish in at Derby every year. And I think that's my last slide. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I have a 20-minute presentation. I've got minus 5 minutes to give it in. To rip. Just go start clicking through those, Heidi. This is me, don't know best. You don't want to know about me, so you can't hear about Pebble, so let's keep going. Keep going. Okay, I want to drive this one home. The first order of business in any project like this is to understand the system, how it works, and why it works that way. So as I go through this thing, just keep that in mind. My mantra is to figure out why it works the way it does. This is what we're going to talk about. We don't need to look at this slide. We can go on. These are the watersheds that feed Bristol Bay. I'm trying to put this whole thing in context. There's the project. These are the various major salmon streams that feed Bristol Bay. Just to get the map in your head, you'll probably know that anyway. Next. Just again, for context, these are some statistics on Sockeye runs in Bristol Bay's 05 data. I've got boxes around these because the catch-to-escapement ratios here are quite low, and we're to protect the unfortunately dwindling Quijack run. And since the Alaknik and the Naknek are fixed in the same zone, and you being fishermen understand this, a lot of fish went back to the, especially the Alaknik and the Naknek, without being caught that would have been otherwise available for the fishery next. This is 06, just out. This is from a summary. It's been out a little while. Things have changed, and this year the big one, the big run, came into the wood. 13 million fish. And since it's fished in the same zone as the Nushagak, in the Nushagak we had a 20-to-1 catch escapement ratio, and the escapement fell to less than half of what it normally is. So we're going to see what happens in the future. That was a real interesting year. Okay, next. This puts the 2 years together. I don't want to spend too much time on this except to point out that the run got a little bit better in 06. But there was a big shift. These are in order of the most production in 05, these rivers. I ranked them. And I kept them in the same rank, and you can see that the percent contribution to the fishery changed a fair bit. Okay, next. This is the land ownership, land status in the Pebble area. And I'm showing this to illustrate that this, well, it's different on the slide, but it's sort of a reddish brown color, is Native Corporation land. This happens to be ABC land, Alaska Peninsula Corporation land out here, and other corporate lands up above. The Blue Estate land. Here are the streams, North Fork of the Coctulee, South Fork of the Coctulee. Upper Tulare Creek wraps around, comes down like this, goes through Native Corporation land. Here's Lower Tulare Creek. And I'm illustrating this because a lot of people who haven't been there think that there's an upper part and a lower part of a creek called Tulare Creek. Not true. Two creeks. Next. Here they are. Upper Tularic, this watershed. Lower Tularic, this watershed. This is the popular one for fishing, for recreational fishing, is Lower Tularic. The ABC land, it comes as lower 8 miles or so of Upper Tularic Creek, and there's very limited access, although there's a contract with one lodge for access to go fishing. Next. You've already seen the site. These are study sites. Next. These little circles that come on are permanent USGS hydrology gauges. These are uplinked to satellite. You can link, you can get real-time flow information anytime you want to dial it up. Next. These are fish tissue sampling sites, these stars that are scattered around. I'll talk a little bit about that later. Next. This is Frying Pan Lake. Next. There's something funny going on in this slide. There it is. And that's what's there. This is in the middle of the lake. That's how deep that lake is. When I have visitors out, when we fly over, I say, guess how deep that is. And that's how deep it is. Okay. This is a list of aquatic biological resource studies. I'm not going to go through them all. Suffice it to say, as Bruce said, we're looking at everything. This is an area that I want to focus on in a moment, and I call it the Springs. It's on the south fork of the Coctulee. And this is where a whole lot of water comes out of the ground. Salmon that swim upstream to spawn in this system swim up to the springs and they quit. And I'll show you why in a minute. Keep going. These are aquatic resource study sites. They're little black dots. They're hard to see in the slide. I apologize for that. This is the deposit area. There's Frying Pan Lake. Anyway, this is where we've been conducting aquatic collecting stuff. Next. You can rip through this. This is just a tool. The helicopter flies along and takes a video. These are geo-reference videos. It's kind of cool, but talk to me later about it. This is, again, the Springs area. We're not just looking in the river, but we're looking in off-channel habitats, censusing the fish that are there, looking at the seasonal use, and doing flow habitat studies there to learn all about it. I just don't have enough time to explain it. Keep going. This is Who's Home, Upper Tulare Creek. That's the list of species. There's chinook in here. When I worked with this project in the early 90s is when I started with this, there weren't any chinook in that system, but they're there now. And we had trouble convincing the locals that there were actually chinook in the system, but they're there. Been there for the last 4 years. Go figure. Next. This is the North Fork, Coctulee. This battery's going on this thing. This is the richest of all the assemblages of fish in this area. And it's a big collection. There's three kinds of whitefish, bourbon, northern pike all over the place, sockeye, chinook, coho chum, rainbows. It's a big long list. Next. This is the South Fork Pokele, a little bit shorter species list, but still a big producer below the springs of salmon and the laymarten and grayling, the odd bourbon, not very many, and northern pike again throughout. Keep going. Fish tissue sampling. There are two kinds we're doing. One is to collect yearling salmonids. This is according to protocols that DNR put forward. They're whole fish sampled, and we're monitoring trace metals. This is going into a pre-operational database. It'll be probably 6, 7, 8 years before we actually get operational. Next, also looking at primarily northern pike, both liver and skeletal muscle. This is because these fish, they attempt to accumulate and concentrate trace elements more than other fish because at the top of the food web. And B, because people eat them. So we want to make sure that we get a good handle on what's going on here. Next. Spawning surveys. Roughly, the North Fork primaries, kings, South Fork, kings and sockeye, upper Fork, sockeye, small run kings, all three streams have coho. Next. Okay, we want to get to this one. These little circles that you see, this infrared photo, each one of those is an accumulation of spawning salmon, an aggregation, maybe a few dozen or 100. And here's the North Fork up here. You can see there's lots of circles coming out. You go to the South Fork here, lots of circles. That's where the springs are. South Fork keeps going up. There's one. That's the only one that's got two fish associated with it. South Fork keeps going, and winds up just down here below the deposit. That's where the springs are. The fish don't go beyond the springs, and this is why. Next. There's South Fork above the springs. Next, there's the same site. In July, there's June, there's July. Goes dry. Goes dry in the winter as well. Next. Ask me about that during question and answer. I got to move through this. Here's some data on North and South Fork escapements for 05. We don't have the 06 data worked up yet, sorry, but it's similar. Hit the next button twice. Okay. These show the sockeye in the North and South Fork country, and the combination. And this fork perspective is the percent of the Nushigak or Kwijak, depending on which system we're looking at, and of the Bristol Bay Run. This is not to minimize the importance of these fish. They're very important. They deserve protection. It's to put it in perspective. Next. Same thing for Chinook. Hit it twice. Chinook are pretty much isolated to the Nushigak in this area. There are some that go elsewhere, but the bulk of them are from the Nushigak, and so the percentages, the percentages are different, a little bit disproportionate. That's the reason. Next. No net loss to fisheries. Bruce talked about that. Why don't you hit it about three times? One more. I want to emphasize that it's not just a gross number of fish someplace. It is end-user focused, subsistence, commercial, and recreational are all considered. It's the same watershed if possible. It's close by if that's not possible. It's the same species, the same stock. Bruce talked about Project Induce being direct or indirect, and the mitigation and compensation is not through propagation. A lot of people waving their arms and hyperventilating about hatcheries and so forth. It's not a consideration of this project. Next. Again, prioritize actions according to user needs, and this means that users are going to be intimately associated with the mitigation and compensation strategies that, that come out of this project. Can't do it without that. Specific measures, just rip through this. 1, 2, 3, 4, okay. Steering the project design is always the best. Ken talked about that a little bit, project operation. Operating plans are a must. You don't get a permit without one. Monitoring is a must, and it's a state requirement and federal requirement. It is very robust. agency oversight beforehand, after development, it's ongoing and it goes on after mine closure. And public participation, Mike talked about already, but it's extremely important. Next. Tailings location, Ken talked about that, the watershed and the subbasin, road alignment and road crossings. We have discussed the same rigor, the same approaches taken for road crossings, other project elements, the mill and so forth. Water balance is important, Ken hit on that, and protection through design of critical habitats and environmental processes is really what drives this, all this stuff. Next. Going beyond secure mitigation opportunities, being on-site, defining priorities of stakeholder input is critical. Compensation is off-site, if necessary, it probably will be, and it can be achieved through increasing productive capacity of certain habitats where that's appropriate, opening new watersheds to anadromous access, if that's what people want, and there are a couple of very nice opportunities in the area. Conservation management in large tracts of land, we're discussing this with the Nature Conservancy, and working with other fishery stakeholders, local native corporations, and local people. This is really a local person-driven process. How do we know? Okay, next. This is Fort Knox. Ken talked about it a little bit. The top is looking at the tailings pond, with beach tailings there. The bottom is Fish Creek below the tailings embankment. You can see it in the background. This is about, I'm crazy, I don't need a lot of this. That's that sort of grayish hill back there. This area was placer mined, dredged, and hydraulic mined, and was really trashed when the developer of the Fort Knox mine, that was Kinross, came on it and got it later on. When they came in, and they immediately started reclaiming the land, even though they hadn't built their own mine yet. And what you have in front of you is a reclamation project in process. But everything that isn't in spruce was basically trashed. Okay, next. Freshwater reservoir, can't talk about it, next. This is what lives there. If you look closely in the center, you'll see a grayling. There it is, next one. And there's a nice yellow tag in that particular grayling. Several thousand have been tagged, and the vermin in the pond eat these. The vermin are getting up to a meter long now, and it's not open for fishing yet, but the area will likely become a recreational, in fact, it will become a recreational area for Fairbanks after closure. Mines tour, okay, this is where the grayling spawn. It's just a remnant of Fish Creek that comes down and was diverted, and it cut its own channel, and as soon as this occurred, it really went up there and spawned, and they're reproducing and doing very well. BC mice tour, next. This is that same tailings pond you've seen, or sinkage pond, excuse me, you've seen in the past. This is the embankment up here. There's some people here at the pump back station. This deepish water is pumped back into the pond because water is a resource you need to run the mill. Next. There's Heidi down there. Next. She's drinking the water. She does this to show off. But this is tailings water. It seeps through the embankments collected here and pumped back. Next. This is the Highland Valley. If you look at the distance, you'll see some waste rock and some of the mine workings. And you see vegetated hillsides back there. All that vegetated hillside has been reclaimed. It's waste rock piles and also the foreground. It's all been subject to reclamation. It's an ongoing project. This process, this project is still active. Next. This is Highland Valley's Trojan Pond, and Ken showed you a couple of shots of it. This is a tailings pond, and the foreground was all tailings beach. Next. And this is what lives in that pond. Bob Hamaguchi is in the upper left. He is the reclamation engineer for Highland Valley. He's an avid fly fisherman, so he just put this thing together. They charge people to come and fish there a fair bit of money, and they get it all together and give it to the Kamloops Hospital. So the local people really like this idea. People come from all over to fish this thing. Keep going. This is a little spawning channel that these trout belong into. It was just a diverted creek, and it didn't take much construction. It diverted the water and runs down into the pond, hit it. And if you look on the left, you'll see fry if your eyes are good. There they are. They're all through there. This is the results of the spawning in that area. These some fish around out of that tailing spawn there and reproduce. At mines like Pebble, the bottom line is that it works. Concurrent reclamation is often implemented. Wildlife and fish and livestock use the mine area during the mine life. Recovery is rapid. Rapid is a relative term. We can talk about that later. Fish and wildlife are not harmed, and tailings facilities often become fish habitat. Not always, but often. I think that's getting close to the end. Oh, that's right. I want to talk about what's wrong with the regen. I'm going to leave this for later. If you want to ask questions about it, you can. This has to do with the cooperative study that's going on. So I'm done.
Thank you, Jim. We had planned to go through the agenda and probably not have the last panel, but I've been told that we should include them. So we're just going to have a couple of minutes with Val and Randy, who came down to get their perspective of this. So Val, and then we'll move into a couple of minutes of question and answer.
I guess we're going to be outside of the box, anyway, some of you might know me. I come from Christian Valley, and in fact, I'm a tree farmer, a younger brother. Some of you have known my father, tree farm senior, born in about 1911, and writer, father, probably know him, go back a long way. Anyway, Tree Fund had asked Randy and I to give a comment about whether we care about this and do we think it's safe and do we think the process is really open door. And we found out in the last month or two that is exactly what is going on. These people I have found 2 days of nothing to hide. And the biggest fear that I have right now is that this process may be compromised. In other words, that there's so much propaganda going on right now in Bristol Bay that I don't think, after about 4 or 5 years from now, that somebody's going to be able to make an objective decision. They've been filled with so much skewed information. But what people and I, like Randy and myself, and Flatter and all these other folks, and Lynn, have come to scrutinize this group with, was that the process be left open and that they give honest information. And I think we found out today that some of the big questions that were being asked are being answered. And that includes dam breaches, how high they are, what's going to happen when they're gone, those sorts of things. We're all asking those questions, and I'll turn it over to Randy.
So you said you're off the hook. Ran out of time. My name is Randy Zimmer. I'm a commercial fisherman and a contractor up at Bristol Bay. I'm born and raised there. And I'm in this for myself, my family. My whole family's been there since the early 1900s. And I'm not going into this with the attitude, get the shovels out and start digging a hole, but I'm also looking at it at a local level, where our economy has really sunk down in the last few years. And we have one access to funding, and that's fishing. Well, I commercial fish also, and if we don't get some other revenue in the area, then we're going to be taxed to death. And so I got to keep an open mind about all this. And there are fishermen and lodge groups that, I don't know if they don't want to come and listen to the facts or the facts that these folks put out. But there are a lot of prejudgments, and like Val, I'm concerned that these prejudgments are going to affect us in the future, because right now they're providing jobs, training, and not everybody fishes in Bristol Bay. Some of us have other things that we do. And it needs to be looked at in all those areas. I'm the first one to tell you, I'm not going to let anybody damage the fishery, but I also would hope that everybody keeps an open mind about this. It's very important, I think, for us locally, and also for the commercial fishermen everywhere. The people that fish and live in Washington are getting the same price I'm getting for my fish. I want to get more fish. These folks are providing that equipment in this mine, and it's a major project. It's going to bring in some sort of transportation system. I want my fish to get to market before the Copper River fish get to market. I'd like my fish to be in the store in New York the same time as the Cook Inlet fish gets there, so I don't get the end table, so I don't get the tailing pile that's left over from them. So just keep all of this stuff in mind before you make your judgments, is all I ask. Thank you.
Thank you, Bruce. You want to touch and answer? Friday.
Well, it's been a bit of a whirlwind afternoon, and we just ran out of time, but we still have some time for questions. There's been a lot of material, and I think we'll just open up the floor and have some questions. We'll direct them to the appropriate specialists if you want to get technical, or I'll give general answers if that's all that's required. So, any questions? Yes.
Thank you, Mike. Right on, yeah.
Thank you. My name is Dan Lawson, and I also commercially fished for years, and my father's a gold miner, so I have some interest in this for several reasons. And also for the last decade, I have been organizing the Go Wild campaign, and I just returned 3 weeks ago from Turin, Italy, where I was at a slow foods gathering, 5,000 food producers and 1,000 chefs. And I have traveled around the country. I've made 2 trips to Europe, to Italy for conferences. I've been to Scotland, Norway. I've looked at a lot of our reputation, of our wild salmon. And I can guarantee that we're going to lose the value of our wild salmon as soon as the public hears cyanide, arsenic, sulfuric acid. So those of us who want to see a sustainable industry and who work really hard to bring up the reputation of wild salmon, we've marketed, we've done taste tests, we've met with retailers and chefs. I brought a coloring closet to require farm salmon to be labeled as containing artificial colorants. That was a turnaround. The public doesn't want contaminated foods. So even if this line is completely environmentally friendly, the perception is our fish are going to be tainted. And so I would like to know, you've said that any opposition is propagandized. I'd like to have you have Dr. Ross Naylor or an independent economist look at what's going to happen to wild fish prices if this mine goes in. Do an independent, have someone do an independent research project. Look at what the perception of wild fish is going to be from Western Alaska if this mine goes in. And if it shows that we're going to lose value of our fisheries, then are you willing to walk away from this project that shows that there's a greater loss than your corporate profits?
Okay, well, you've raised a number of issues there, and I think I got a question near the end. Let me try to deal with them one point at a time. First and foremost, the issue and concern that you raise is a legitimate concern, and it speaks to the benefit of open forums like this, because you can communicate to us those concerns, and we can make sure that they're properly addressed in our work. Having said that, the issue you've raised has been on our checklist of concerns and subject to study since day one of our project, so it's not a new issue. The second point I'd like to say is just because someone has that question or that concern does not make it a fact. So I respect your right to stand up and say that's what you think is going to happen, but I don't want anyone to conclude that that is a fact. That's your opinion, and there's a difference between opinion and fact. Third point I'd like to make is that while we wait for all of these independent studies to be done on that and a host of other questions, a reasonable person on issues of that nature would look to other precedents to determine whether it passes the test of reasonableness. And I can tell you with assurance that the concern you raise and the conclusion you reach that the value of fish from Bristol Bay will be compromised by one mine in the watershed is flawed when you look at other watersheds with salmon and vibrant commercial fisheries. All you have to do is look at the Fraser River in British Columbia, which has had, in the last 100 years, hundreds of mines, and currently has more than 8 or 10 large open pit mining operations for the last couple of decades. The net effect over 20 to 30 years of operating those mines on the major Fraser River watershed in BC, the net effect on the fisheries has been zero. And the effect of those mines in that Fraser River watershed in central British Columbia on the price per pound of salmon has been zero. The perception of the Fraser River sockeye and other salmon species as being a healthy, high-quality fish has not been compromised by the presence of mines, let alone clear-cut logging and lots of communities without sewage treatment and all kinds of other land use impacts. Still does not affect the price of the fish. Having said that, it will be studied, and we will present in the permitting process the results of those studies by independent experts, and we will also present the details from the case history studies elsewhere in the world that points to the fact that this can happen, and you can have healthy fisheries and mining projects coexist.
I have a question. Has anybody here seen the movie
Question up front here.
Y'all seen Thank You for Smoking?
Yes, it's a good movie. We're going to let him have a question.
I hadn't seen the word cyanide or arsenic in your presentation. Is that part of the plan on site?
It's not part of the plan. Arsenic is one of the elements that's found in the ore in very trace amounts, and it's being studied. With respect to cyanide, it's one of a host of different chemicals that have been looked at for the gold extraction circuit. And one of the options was to use a closed circuit, like they have at Fort Knox, for extracting the gold and having a cyanide destruction circuit. That has not been selected as the milling and metal extraction process yet. It's early days, and if it is selected, then the studies outlining why that's not going to cause pollution will be clearly shared and shown to everybody. But there, it's way too early to decide what the metallurgical process is that we'll use at the pebble mine.
Okay. My next question is, actually, I'm Mark Minsel. I'm Executive Director of the United Fishermen of Alaska. One of the things that troubles me most deeply about the work that I've been doing and that all Alaska fishermen have done is that Bristol Bay salmon fish, you know, Bristol Bay's prices are still at the levels they were in 2002. All the work we've done hasn't helped them very much, and it's pretty clear that they need infrastructure, they need electricity that's not from diesel. There's a whole host of things that they need to be able to join most of the rest of Alaska's salmon fisheries in prices, in the price rebounds. Is there any way that your project can help? Is there any plan to either with you know, transportation infrastructure, you can have a dealing in some of those communities, or electricity from some other source, or any other. Actually, the local people should know most about what they need to get more money out of their fish.
There's a significant infrastructure component to the project, including 150 to 200 plus megawatts of power being brought in, and we put aside 15 to 20 megawatts of that power for local communities, including upgraded existing roads and construction of new roads and new ports. Those are some examples. We're not planning to build roads or power lines down to Dillingham. We're not the state of Alaska. We're here to build a mine. But we are good neighbors, and we'll share the infrastructure to the extent possible with proper planning. And if you think there are synergies with your industry and our project, this is a big project with significant opportunities, with a massive cash flow. Lots of opportunities for synergy for us as a good neighbor to work with other industries to help enhance the success of their industry. So I encourage you to contact us, and let's have some follow-up meetings and do some planning.
My name is Nadine LaPierre. I'm a stakeholder of Bristol Bay, and I was mildly curious. I was out of town, so I learned of this meeting and this presentation by word of mouth. But how was it, how did you make the invitation available to the public?
Were you talking to Bill?
What was the question?
how is this publicized? Because we have our fish expo coming now tomorrow, and a lot of fishermen would have been here, but how is this publicized? Because they're all busy setting up and getting ready.
We went on the radio. I did an extensive interview with Lanny Welch, who went on Fish Alaska and then did some whatever article she writes, Fish Factor. She talked a lot about the meeting that we were going to have here. We also emailed organizations, about every known fishery organization around that we have a list of. I believe I sent out over 40 emails to different fishery organizations. But they've been a couple of them. Bob Thorsenson, if you say you're from UMA, he just sent me a thank you for sending him an agenda.
I saw it on the seafood.com, and then I relayed it on Monday night to my email list with the, about
people. I think whatever it's worth, this isn't going to be the last fishery meeting there is. We certainly wanted to begin to explain to the public that this is not the final meeting, that this is just the early stages of informational meetings.
If I might add, just to exemplify that point, this wasn't intended to be a one-off event to cover the entire commercial fishing industry. That's not possible in 2 or 3 hours in one small venue such as this, but I think it's a good start. By way of example, in the first year of our operations in 2004, when we started our work, we had 64 meetings with all the stakeholders and agencies. In the next year, we had over 165 meetings. And this year will be over 325, 350 meetings. We're ratcheting up and doing more and more meetings, sharing more information as people express an interest to learn about the project. If you think someone should have been here and they weren't, then let Heidi know, and they can be specifically invited with your assistance for the next round of meetings.
Yes.
Hi, I'm Janice
Carcel.
I'm the business manager for AFLA, the largest association in Bristol Bay, and we did not get anything. I just heard from the word of mouth. And I'm also
so something's working, did you hear?
Right. And I'm also a registered dietitian, so I have an interest in mercury. Is mercury an air contaminant and may result from power in the mine?
The question asked is mercury an air contaminant associated with the generating of power?
That may result from powering the mine, such as coal.
Based upon the preliminary work done today, no. Because we're not looking at using coal as a fuel source for the generation of electricity. We're looking at natural gas.
Were you with natural gas?
We're looking at natural gas through a cooperative venture with Homer Electric Association on the Kenai. And the natural gas supply will either be from Cook Inlet, because the gas suppliers assure us there's plenty of natural gas. The real question is, what's its price going to be? But we have contingency plans for bringing in LNG from Asia and others alternate fuel sources if for some reason the cost of the gas out of Cook Inlet becomes excessive. So we have a series of sensitivity analyses that show the preferred fuels doesn't include coal.
And are you going to withdraw water from the upper Kartuli, or where are you going to get the water from?
And you should know, we have submitted 3 water rights applications to the Department of Natural Resources in the last 5 or 6 months, and in response to DNR's deficiency letter, have submitted a total of about 1,300 pages worth of information and data to support those applications. They are for 3 different locations based upon the location of the tailings facilities, in particular for South Port Kartuli, because as you can imagine, when you put an embankment in, the water that flows at that embankment point is captured or trapped behind the embankment. For you to do that, you have to have a water rights application. Now that water has a number of beneficial uses. 1, we use the water for the mill process. 2, we use the water for the sub-aqueous storage of the reactive tailings and waste rock. 3, we use the water in a controlled fashion for supplementing stream flows downstream and a whole host of other beneficial uses. So the simple answer to your question is, based on the design of the project to date, and that's an important qualifier because the project design hasn't been finalized, but based on our design considerations to date,
we've submitted those three water rights applications because we know them be taking water from North Fork Coctuli, South Fork Coctuli, and a tiny bit of from the Upper Delaware Creek just because of the location of the pit and the dewatering wells that we would put in to keep the workings dry. Other questions? Yes?
My name's Tom Rance, and I'm here with fisheries. I was wondering, how much salmon habitat is within the site of the mine? The tailings pond?
Oh, sorry, the tailings pond and the pit. How much habitat is there currently?
There's no spawning habitat up there, but we do get juveniles that cobble that push up into the Front End Lake area and then on beyond because some of the creeks are not very many. We get, you know, six or a dozen fish each year when we sample out there. It's nothing like the other areas, but it is used for rearing to a limited extent. Front End Lake itself is too warm. It's quite warm, really, in the summertime. It's shallow and very weedy. So grayling and Dolly Varden and Tumacobo and whatnot push out of the lake and they go up into other little creeks where it's cooler. Northern pike live in that lake, and they live in a lot of the other lakes around. But in terms of spawning habitat, in the South Fork Coctuli, it is from the springs downstream. We have the odd cobo that will come up Upper Tulare Creek and push into the margins of the pit area, but that doesn't happen every year. In fact, it's rare, but it does happen occasionally. So
there is some habitat that will be lost.
Some, but very little.
But very little.
And the reason for that, in large measure, is because of the environmental design approach, where the scientists work with the engineering team to situate the facilities away from the critical salmon habitat.
Yeah, as one would expect. I mean, most of us aren't. If we propose a project that negatively impacts salmon rearing habitat, it's summarily rejected. So I think that's the expectation within the state.
And fair enough, but keep in mind, as was said earlier, 30, 40 years ago, that's not the way mines were built. We're designing and proposing a project with modern standards.
I agree. But I think it's the expectation within the state that you'll have no impact on salmon rearing habitat. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Patrick Gladney, and I work with the Bristol Bay Alliance organization, a nonprofit. I'm their outreach coordinator, and like Tree Pond, we try hard to provide factual information that's based on sound science, and that's the truth. And we try hard to be objective, too. And in that light, I'd like to ask Mr. Jenkins a question at the end of a little dissertation here, if you wish to hear me. Last spring, in a conversation with the vice president of Techcomico, we asked him this question. Why did Techcomico partner of NANA Development Corporation, the business arm of NANA Regional Native Corporation, who owns and operates the Red Dog Mine, the largest lead and zinc, or at least the richest lead and zinc, I think, is that not true, Bruce, in the world, near Kotzebue, Alaska, choose to divest of the remaining interest in the proposed double project? Now, keep in mind that the Northern Dynasty Company, correct me if I'm wrong, is what's termed in the industry as a junior mining company. They're tasked mainly with two, our understanding is that they're tasked with two main missions. One is to locate the wealth, get it measured and indicated, and then do what's necessary to get the project permitted. Techcomico is a large mining company, very large. And they choose to walk away from this project, and this is what their vice president told us. During an informal discussion, a representative of Techcomico indicated they chose not to further their involvement in the Pebble project for both environmental and economic reasons. The pebble deposit contains low-grade copper, gold, and I can't pronounce it, but we're going to call it moly. Detkomenko believed, in his opinion, that the combined values of these metals, coupled with the significant transportation and power infrastructure costs, was not sufficient to justify the large capital investment they would have to make in order to develop this deposit. Now keep in mind, this statement came and they divested themselves of the remaining share of their claims after the 2005 drilling results came in.
So can we go to the question?
It's right here. The pebble deposit occurs in an environmentally sensitive area, and Detkomenko expressed concern that even after extensive baseline studies and monitoring and the design of potential mitigation measures, the project might still not be environmentally acceptable. As a result of these factors, they chose to end their participation in the pebble claim lot. Now, our question to you is, you being a junior mining company, an exploration company, why do you feel that you can do it safe enough and Detkomenko did?
Excellent question, and there are actually three embedded questions in that final general question, so I want to deal with it one at a time. First and foremost, you're wrong about us being just a junior. If it wasn't for junior mining companies, there wouldn't be very many mines in the world. More importantly, Northern Dynasty is on the record as saying we're committed to this process to be partners through the production of the mine. Some of our sister companies are operating some of the largest open pit copper mines in British Columbia. We're not just the junior company and all the pejorative negative impressions that kind of terminology is intended to convey. So you're wrong in that regard. Secondly, I don't know what vice president you were talking to, but Detkomenko has a lot of them. And I can assure you it wasn't vice presidents that were making the decision on whether or not Detkomenko should be involved in Pebble. It was the board of directors. So I don't know who your information source is, but if you only spoke to one vice president, I can assure you, you're not getting the whole picture. Thirdly, you should be better off asking yourself, why did Detkomenko walk away, but Rio Tinto Kennecott just put $87.5 million to acquire 9.9% of our company because of the Pebble project? And the answer to that more important question is, because since Detkomenko stopped spending money on the project, we invested tens of millions of dollars and added hundreds of additional drill holes and found what Detkomenko didn't find, which was a high-grade resource in Pebble West. They had 1 billion tons of low-grade. We have 4.1 billion tons of high-grade, something they didn't think was there, but our geologists found it. More importantly, we've also got 30 or 40 holes in Pebble East that has 2 billion to 4 billion and counting tons of very high-grade deep water, a deep underground resource. These are mineral resources, tons and grades, that Detkomenko knew nothing about. And we're still adding to the resource with our current drill program. As a consequence of finding the higher-grade additional tonnage, the economics of the project are completely different than the economics of the project that Detkomenko looked at 10 years ago. Another point, you make reference to Detkomenko's extensive environmental studies. Wrong. They did not conduct extensive environmental studies. You saw an example of extensive environmental studies here, where $40 to $50 million is being spent. Not reconnaissance-level studies like Detkomenko did. And I think to sum up and to finally address your question, the mining industry is a dynamic industry. And mining companies add and divest themselves of properties all the time. And they never do that for any one reason. To give you some empirical evidence to reinforce that the Pebble deposit is a world-class deposit of significant interest to major mining companies, we have 18, count them, 18 confidentiality agreements with internationally recognized major mining companies that are bigger than Detkomenko. Copper companies, gold companies, We have them shortlisted down, and we're negotiating a joint venture company with this short list of companies as we speak, and there will be announcements in the coming months to that effect, consistent with the project development plan that we identified more than 2 or 3 years ago. We're on track, and we're doing what we said we were going to do. Not just explore and get permits, but take this project through a JV, joint venture company, to construction and operation. I think that should be enough information and empirical evidence to suggest that the fact that Cominco is not a partner with us anymore has absolutely nothing to do with the merit of this deposit, the merit of this project, and the fact that it will be built.
Is it likely that you will be the managing partner if this mine gets permitted?
The very reason that we're looking for major mining companies is that we want an operator with large mine operating experience. Northern Dynasty will not be the managing partner or the operator, but we will be a partner. We own 100% of that deposit, and we will own a major portion of it as we go through with the joint venture company.
Rio Tinto owns
9%. Rio Tinto owns 9.9%. Not 90, 9.9. Less than 10%. You're making a mistake by confusing the difference between the ownership of the property and the minerals and the shareholdings of Northern Dynasty, the company. Rio Tinto Kennecott spent $87.5 million to buy 9.9% of the shares in Northern Dynasty Minerals. There is no connection in that agreement and no vote for them to own anything of the deposit or the project. And there is no commitment in that shareholding investment that they made to even be partners on the Pebble Deposit JV, although they may well be. So there's a difference between owning shares in Northern Dynasty and owning the minerals and the metal in the ground.
I'm Daniel Schindler. I'm a professor at the University of Washington Aquatic and Fisheries Sciences School. I'm currently part of a group generally known as the Fisheries Research Institute that's worked in Bristol Bay for over 50 years. A couple comments and then a general question. First comment is that I guess I wouldn't be too quick to take credit for starting this MOLT study on Iliamna Lake. University of Washington and more recently Alaskan Fish and Game has actually been doing that for over 50 years. Last year was certainly a year that was a budgetary tight year, and certainly your funding helped out.
Well, I want to quickly respond before you go on. I did not take credit for initiating it. I made a statement of fact, which was this year we were approached and we responded positively to partner in the funding of that small smolt migration study. That's all I said.
Those weren't the words I remembered. Second issue is one of the things that we've learned after studying salmon populations in Bristol Bay for over 50 years is that when we evaluate what the value of habitat is, any two-year slice is a very often provided misconception about what valuable habitat actually is. So over the course of decades, we might get a glimpse of what the usable habitat is by salmon. In the case of the Klejak right now, with the runs being low, escapements being low, chances are a very small fraction of potential usable habitat is actually being used by fish in the system right now. So I would be very wary about a few snorkel surveys and a couple spawning ground surveys providing a picture of the long-term potential productivity of the habitat in the system.
Fair enough. Before you leave that, I'll then turn this over to Dr. Buell to comment on further detail as appropriate. But you are creating the impression that our studies are intended to document the entire productive capacity of the salmon-bearing streams in Bristol Bay, and that's wrong. More importantly, and perhaps more to the point, the company is not doing, to use your words, just a few spawning surveys at a few locations. We're spending millions of dollars with extensive coverage over multiple years of the three major drainages in the project Pebble Deposit area. Multiple years. We're finishing year three as we speak. We will be continuing in year 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10, straight through the construction, operation, and closure is beyond the mine. Once we start the environmental studies, they don't end. More importantly, I want to finish my answer, please.
More importantly, we have the benefit of Dr. Buell's work of 10 years ago at the Pebble Deposit, Fisheries and Aquatic Studies, Dr. Smith's terrestrial resource studies at the Pebble Deposit more than 10 years ago for Cominco, which spans multiple decades. So to infer that we're not doing much environmental work by your question is wrong.
I guess to follow up on your answer, I'm asking you to focus it a little bit and get some acknowledgement that the mapping of habitat used by salmon in any given year, or any given two or three, or if you want to call it 10 years, is always a subset of all the habitat used by the population.
You're right.
Over the long term. So when the question comes up about whether habitat is being impacted, you have to address it beyond the spatial scale of the observations that occur in any given year.
And what makes you think that we're not? The bottom line is we are, and your comment again is misleading because we're not just mapping habitat used by fish, although that is an important component of the work that Dr. Buell and his team are doing, but we're also measuring, mapping, and measuring habitat that's not used by fish, but has the potential to support fish. So we don't restrict ourselves to just survey where the fish are.
Second question is a more general question. And if we look at the reputation or the history of hard rock mining across the world, even in North America, even in the last 20 years, through processes that have gone through this environmental impact assessment that you have described, to be generous, I think we can call the record being pathetic. So the question is, that what we keep hearing from this group is, wait and see, let us finish. The question to you is, why should we believe you, given the reputation of the industry in the past?
That's a very good question. I'm really glad that you asked it. The premise of your question, sir, is wrong. The mining industry record in the last 20 years is not pathetic, as you assert. In fact, the empirical evidence clearly shows that problems with mines are the exception, not the rule. And anybody who may be ideologically disposed to argue against Pebble can very easily find examples of mines in the world or North America to point to the horrors of mining. They're typically mines that were not permitted properly, are old, were improperly bonded because the state permitting process was not thorough enough and the legislation wasn't as advanced as it is today or as it is in Alaska today. All kinds of reasons, but the point is, they're the exception, not the rule, and the performance of the mining industry has not been pathetic with respect to environmental protection. On the contrary, there are thousands and thousands of mines in the world, and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of mines in North America, the vast majority of which have not compromised the environment.
More than anything, I just kind of take offense. I came down from Alaska to listen to constructive dialogue about this mine. I've got a professor over here that's complaining and raising his voice, and I got some guy over here, and I got some lady that probably has a job down here making $100,000 a year. Not you. We live there, okay? We live there, not you. Let's get that straight. We live there. We're born and raised there. I didn't come down and try to stop logging down here. I don't come and get into your business. You might fish up there, but that's where it ends. You take your money and you leave, okay? All we're asking you is this. You need to keep an open mind. You're going to also pay in the long run. We need infrastructure up there, and we need some capital investment. We have fishing right now. You wait about 5 to 10 years and see how much your fish taxes are in Bristol Bay. And then come talk to me and tell me about the mine.
Well, we're starting to run out of time, and some of us have airplanes to catch, so we will take one more question. The president?
Just one quick question. If you can tell me the number of failures of earth demand, say, in the last 100 years, and wait, I'm not done. The maximum height of failed earth demand. Just
well, I need to give a general answer, then I'll pass it over to Ken, who's the engineer. But when you saw his list of the 69 or 70 high embankments and dams, and when I asked the author of the study how many of those high embankments and dams had failed, none of them did.
So are you telling me that there have been no earth fill dam failures of any kind?
No, that...
That's not
what I said. What I said was that...
You know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of some of the archival footage watching the guys from Army Corps of Engineers before Hurricane Katrina with all the trucks and crafts saying, hey, we got it covered. That's what it sort of sounds like.
Yeah, well, that's fine. That you're entitled to your impression. The point we're trying to make is, here's the science, here's the engineering, the empirical evidence is clear. Of those 69 high embankments, none of them failed. I'll let Ken Trower, the engineer, who has more detailed information about it, respond.
I looked into this a while back. I mean, I think I came up with some statistics that said there are over 55,000 large dams in the world that are on various registers. Okay. There have been a few studies that have looked at a number of failures, etc. I can't remember the actual numbers off the top of my head, but it's a very, very small percentage of that 55,000 dam structures. There are some literature around that can point to some more specific details on that, but for the moment, all I can say is it's a very small number.
Thanks again. Look, we'll bring the questions to a close now, but I just want to make an observation and a comment. First of all, I want to thank you for your patience and your attention. It's been a long afternoon, and some of the presentations were pretty incredibly detailed, even though they've just scratched the surface of what they've been doing. We look forward to an opportunity to have more forums like this in the future, perhaps with more time available to get into more dialogue and discussions. I want to reiterate that the company does not dispute the right of anybody to hold an opinion for or against this project. But I do ask that you not jump to conclusions about the project before all the empirical evidence is on the table. And remember that this is a democracy, and we have the right to be where we are, and we have the right to invest our money and to put our science through the state and federal permitting process to determine whether it's permittable. And we have no guarantees it will be permittable, but we're confident with our science that we'll be able to permit it. Time will tell, and if we can't get it permitted, back to one of the ladies' questions, we'll pack our bags and go home. Thank you very much.